Okay, if I could have your attention. If I could have your attention before I turn it over. Sometimes they mistake us anyway, but this is not Ken Metz yet. But it will be in about 30 seconds. So I'm going to let him do all the welcoming announcements first. Please, a couple more hours. Buy the scholarship tickets, the CCB scholarship tickets. Please turn them into registration before 5 p.m. Don't do it at the bank before 5. So that's the first announcement. Second announcement, if by some chance you are going to be here tomorrow after 12 and you live on the fifth floor or higher, there's going to be a need to turn off the water. Well, I just heard about that. I would have obviously told you sooner. 12 p.m. For the rest of the day. So, those of you... Oh, it is going to be off. We will have to ask at the front desk. I'm told it is not certain. We don't know for certain how long it will be. But, yes, that is Sunday. That is Sunday. And most people will be out, but not everybody. And so we will check with the front desk and see what can be done to deal with. I have never heard that situation before. But in case it happens, I did want you to be prepared ahead of time for the contingency. We can always get better news, but at least you got the worst of it. Okay, I'm going to turn it over to the presiding officer for the day, Second Vice President Ken Metz.
Thank you, Jeff, and good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the third session of our spring 2005 CCB convention here in Sacramento. And hello out there, all of you also listening to our stream as we go out into ACB Radio. There you go. We would very much like to ask for your cooperation in trying to be just a little quiet today so that we can hear all the speakers and enjoy ourselves at the same time. To start with, before we go into the pledge, I'm going to see if we have some announcements, and I'm going to start with the first one. So, we'll do that in a short time. We can't do a door prize until we have the pledge and the invocation, Dominic. It wouldn't be kosher. And, you know, tonight is Passover, so we have to, you know. Okay, one of the things that's happening, I just want to mention very quickly at the Foundation for the Junior Blind, we have Alumni Association for the Davidson Program for Independence folks who have graduated and the former VIP program, Visually Impaired Program. What we're doing is also going to start including those folks who were with the foundation back in the 50s and 60s. Those of you who used to remember the Friday night dances and Saturday activities. And what we're going to be doing on May 7th is we are trying to get the group together for, even though it's a Saturday night instead of Friday, we're going to have a dinner and dance in the gym at the foundation. It will be from 5 to 9:30 p.m. You need to come in the back gate, and if anyone would like, please get in touch with me before by a week from Monday at the latest. At the latest, the cost will be $7. I will be making somewhere around 30 quarts of homemade chili. One pot will be spicy and one will be mild. We'll have cornbread, and we will also have soft drinks and bottled water, salad, and cookies and snacks during the dance. So it'll just be an old-fashioned dance going with some music back from the 50s, 60s, and also music of the current time for the new people. So, again, please give me a call. I think Dan's had my chili before. And he still hasn't recovered. He has something only afterwards, Margie. And so, thank you. So please give me a call either at home or at work and let me know if you're going to be able to make it so I have an idea of how much food to do. Any other announcements? Okay. So for right now, let's begin our session. And in order to present the colors, I'd like to introduce from the Capital Chapter a longstanding member, Mr. Warren Cushman. It's nice to be nice, you guys.
Hello, everyone. It's Warren Cushman, and it's nice to be back. All right. I'm going to introduce friends of mine who are also Boy Scouts and a couple of leaders. This troop is being led by Michael Fry and Russell Wayman, who are members not only of the Boy Scout troop, but also members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And with no further ado, we will move on with the Color Guard being done today with Boy Scout Troop 222.
Color Guard, attention. Color Guard, forward march. Color Guard, post colors. Audience, please rise. Will the audience please join me in the Pledge of Allegiance?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Audience, please be seated.
Thank you very much to Scout Troop 222 of Sacramento. Let's hear it for them. All right. It's great to know that young folks, you know, we only hear the bad things they do, and It's really nice that they join us and many of our conventions to help out with posting the colors. And scouting is a wonderful program. Thanks so much again for Scout Troop 222. And before I introduce him, let me just see, is Mr. Singh in the audience? He's not here. Okay, for invocation, I'll just do a short one to fill in. Let's just take a moment. Heavenly Father, we thank you for the opportunity to get together, to be in convention here in the city of Sacramento, and to do the work that you would want us to have done. We appreciate the opportunity to be here, to serve you, in order to realize that we, in fact, are all a part of an integral society. We ask your assistance in making sure that everything we do this weekend is not only for your good, but for ours as well, so that we can all work together in a very honest, fun, and also a very faithful and a very lucrative opportunity for everybody. We pray in your name. Amen.
Amen.
I might have a new job coming up after this.
That's right.
Yeah.
Be careful when you volunteer.
All right. Oh, Mr. Mundy is now here.
Oh, well, you know what? We're going to have two invocations because our person did show up. He got to hear my short one, and then you'll get, let me introduce. Now you get the real thing. Okay, let's give him your attention. It gives me a great opportunity to introduce Mr. Darshan Singh Mundy from the Sikh Temple in Sacramento. Mr. Mundy?
Mm-hmm.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's my pleasure to be here.
Can you get close to the mic?
It's my pleasure to be here to join you. And we will share some of our faith, and then we do the prayers together. I belong to a Sikh religion. This is the youngest religion in the world. We have a religion is formed by the 10 prophets, number 1 to 10. So 10th one created the real Sikh. First prophet called Guru Nanak, and the 10th prophet called Guru Gobind Singh Ji. So we go like a god. We call Ikko Unkar. This is the first word of the Sikh holy scripture, Shri Guru Granth Sahib, we call it. It means God, the enlightener. This term has been explained in the very first verse of the Shri Guru Granth Sahib, which is our holy book, wherein the definition of God has been given. The whole of the Sikh holy scripture in the praise of Ikko Unkar. The absolute God, Nirankar, is formless and beyond creation, but Ikko Unkar is in the subtle of the God light and is in the creation. This light wisdom is the first form creation of God, and His presence can be perceived in the mind through this wisdom. God light is present in everyone, yet is one in essence. He is the same absolute God, not different from that. Light is in all, and that light is God Himself. It is His light that enlightens all minds. Those who believe in presence of God, Ikko Unkar, do not discriminate among mankind. The 10th Guru, Guru Gobind Singh, said, recognize ye all the human race as one. So the Sikhs should respect all, be polite to everyone, be helpful to others, no backbiting, be truthful and honest in their daily lives. The Sikhs do not believe in caste system. There is no discrimination on sex basis either. All men and women are equal in the eyes of God, and they are supplementary to each other in society. Men and women have equal rights in religious matters. Both are appointed as priests, preachers. All can worship, attain the spiritual heights. Our sixth prophet, this is the real story when sixth prophet was present. I'm sorry to say, lots of people, we cannot see the world. So there was one follower in sixth prophet, and he, like if from inside true, he wanted to see him. And this religion is formed in India, so in summer it gets pretty hot over there. And in one of the summer, that person, he left home like in afternoon. It was too hot. And he lost on the way. When he lost, he don't know where to go. And then sometime, he keeps turning his directions of the body. He sat down. So he remembered the sixth prophet. Hey, Lord, can you come and meet me? Like, he was there for maybe a long time. And then he changes all directions, east, west, south, north. And every time he goes, he remembers him and he says, I want to see him. I want to see you. And Lord was there somewhere close by, and so he was resting in somebody's house. It was afternoon, some rich person. And all of a sudden, then sixth prophet, he just got up and he told the owner of the house, bring my horse, I got to go. And he said, no, it's too hot. Where are you going to go? He said, no. My follower is waiting for me. I got to go there. And sixth prophet, he comes on the horse and he reaches the same place. He comes and to his sick, he got in the lap and he says, to whom you're waiting, I'm here. And ask what you need. Tell me what I can do for you. You want money? He said, no. He said, you want diamonds? The person who cannot see blind, he says, no, I don't want nothing. And the guru said, I'm asking you third time. What do you need? Tell me what you need. And then the follower said, I just want to see you. And the guru said, okay, open your eyes. And there he sees the guru and happy. So with his hand on the guru's face and all, he touches the face, his beard, his body. He says, now I can see you. But then the God said, how are you going to live? You need something to live, but you did not ask for the money. And that person, he said, no, I have seen you. I have met you, and I don't need anything else. No, he says, still you need something. Then person, he said, I don't want to see anything else. Why don't you take my eyes away and take me from this world? God says, what do you ask me for this? I can't do this. He says, no, please. You ask, so you got to complete my wish. He wanted to meet with the God he met, and then he just, God, where has to go? So in our life, everybody wants to meet or see God. And I am sorry, some of you cannot see this beautiful world. And I will, as per our faith, do the prayers. In our prayers, we remember the names for our all 10 prophets, then who sacrificed lives for the faith, for the charity, and all those we remember. This is the tradition, if you don't mind, I don't know whosoever, if you can stand, I really appreciate it, so we can join all in the prayers. Having the first to remember God and Almighty, think of Guru Nanak, then of Angad Guru, Amar Das, and Amar Das. May they help us remember Arjun, Har Gobind, and the holy Har Rai. Let us think of the holy Har Krishan, whose sight dispels all sorrow. Let us remembering Tegh Bahadur, and the nine treasure shall come hasting to our homes. May they all assist us everywhere. May the 10th Guru Gobind Singh, the protector of the faith, assist us everywhere. Turn your thoughts, O Khalsa, of the teaching of the Guru Granth Sahib, and call on God, wonderful Lord. The five beloved ones, the master of the sons of 40 saves one and the other, righteous, steadfast, and long-staffing souls, think of their deeds and call on God, wonderful Lord. Those men and women who, keeping the name of the Lord in their hearts, share their earnings with others, who plight the sword and practices charity, who saw others false but overlook them. Think of their deeds and call on God, wonderful Lord. Those who for their religion allowed themselves to be cut limb by limb, had their scraps scraped off, were broken on the wheels, were sawn or flayed alive. Think of the sweet resignation and call on God, wonderful Lord. Those who purge the temples for long-standing evils, suffered themselves to be ruthlessly beaten, imprisoned, to be shot, cut up, burnt alive with kerosene oil, but did not make any resistance or utter even sigh of complaint. Think of their patient faith and call on God, wonderful Lord. O kind Father, through the mercy we have spent rest of the day and morning, last night, very nicely, in the peace and happiness, may the grace extend to our hours of the day too, so that we may, according to Thy, we do what in right, give us light, give us understanding, so that we may know what please the teeth. Forgive us our sins, help us to keep ourselves pure, bring us into the fellowship of only those men who love, in whose company we may remember the name, Sait Nanak, the name forever, to be on the increase. All may all humanity prosper by the grace, He calls of the wonderful Lord, who is always victorious. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Mundy. Appreciate it. Okay, with that, I would like to ask Kathy Skivers to come up. I know that all of you know that we met with the nominating committee, and she's going to come up and give you a report of last night. And then we'll do door prizes. She just won't tell you the things that happened between the various votes.
Oh, yes, I am. I want to tell you all that those of you presidents who sent your people and your chapter sent people in to work on this nominating committee, you ought to be proud. It was very late work. And the easy thing that could have been done would just say okay to any contest. You had a wealth of talent in this, and it showed last night because many people were not. And there were some contests, some close ones, and everybody was in good spirits. And they were all very helpful to me, substitute chair that I was, and they did things like Ken kept time for me, and I got to thinking, you know, I thought it was really great they were all helping me so much. But do you suppose they were helping me that much because they thought I wasn't going to be able to do it? I thought about that later. Anyway, I thank them all for their help, and we had 7 positions to work on. All groups were present. We had 27 votes. With 27, we get one vote for each affiliate or chapter, and we regret that the Silicon Valley Council did not have their representative present, or was there one from Solano. But this was what we came up with. For second vice president, these are nominations from the nominating committee. Second vice president, Gene Lozano Jr. For secretary, Ardis Bazin. And directors, Jerry Arakawa, Al Bigler, Jane Cardis, and Gene Lozano had termed out. He's served us 4 2-term years, so in his in that position, Ann Kaiser has been nominated. And last but certainly not least, for another term, Richard Rueda has been nominated. Now, you know, in the fall, for those of you who aren't familiar with us, in the fall we do our elections, and at that time people can be nominated from the floor. But let me tell you, one and all, if you're going to nominate somebody, have their permission, know something about them, and come in and make that known to us. Also, please, ladies and gentlemen, go back to your chapters. Make sure your lists are in. Make sure your dues are in. It didn't smart too much this time when you couldn't come to the nominating committee, but it smarts a lot when you can't vote in elections. So please do take care of that. It's been my pleasure to substitute for Frank. And just like Cinderella last night, we all left at midnight, and right now I'm going to leave now. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathy. I'm sorry. You said you're going to get something about it? No. Oh, okay. All right. We're going to do a couple of door prizes. We have a tote bag and a T-shirt from Capital Chapter for our first door prize.
What's it say?
Not what we said, Dan. Joan Patchy, are you here? There she is. All right.
This is one with her phrase on it. What's the phrase on it? What's the phrase?
Yeah. What is the phrase on there, Ed?
Oh, it's the I gotta say.
Mr. President, Ms. Patchy coined the phrase "conserve energy, read in the dark." That was her phrase.
That's great. And we'll have one more prize. Let's see what we're gonna. A bag of fresh baked mother's cookies. Who is it? Lee Morton, are you in the room? All right. They'll be fresh until she opens them and passes them around, I guess. Okay. Go on there. Okay. All right. Now we'll do another one in a little while. Not yet. But I do want to thank all of you for your support in bringing door prizes. It really makes it a lot more fun, a lot more interesting. And I know we all appreciate the opportunity to, well, it's a better opportunity than the lottery, just not as much on the value, but it certainly helps. It gets us home while we can eat. all right, with that, I think some of you would probably like to know a little more of what's going to happen in Las Vegas for the ACB convention. And to bring that to you, we have Ms. Cynthia Towers. She's a teacher in the Seattle Public Schools and also a CB board member. And all I can say, Viva Las Vegas. Let's learn about the upcoming ACB National Convention. Cynthia.
Give me a V.
B.
Give me an E.
E.
Give me a G.
G.
Give me an A.
A.
Give me an S.
S.
What's that spell?
A.
All right. By applause, how many of you have ever attended an ACB convention, national? All right. Got some veterans. By applause, who plans to attend July 2 to 9? Oh, all right. I am here. I've been invited to talk with you. Can everybody hear me? I've been invited to talk with you about the upcoming ACB 44th Annual National Convention of the American Council of the Blind. Over the past 4 years, I have served as the convention coordinator, and I am here to tell you just a few things. Now, I'm going to tell you some of the things that are in my May Braille Form article. Somebody said, well, I already read that. I said, no, you didn't. You read April. So You always have to send the articles in a month in advance. And so when you get it, you can just skip over it because this is quite a bit of it. Number one, first thing, we are meeting at the Riviera Hotel and Casino. It is located, I forget which end of the strip, north, south. All right, then you know. Anyway, here's the important thing. Listen up, please. Now, I'm a teacher, so if you talk while I'm talking, I'm going to send you out in the hall. Then I'll call your parents. All right. The Riviera, when you get to the airport, people have been asking me, what's the address? I don't know. And the cab drivers do not go by addresses. It is their business to know where the hotels are. You're going to find, if you've never, by applause, who's ever been to Vegas at all? Okay. Then you know that it's a city unlike any other. I've been asked a lot of different questions with regard to some things, like cabs. Their cabs run 24/7. When you get there...
Cynthia, let me interrupt one sec. Please, please turn off your cell phones. Please.
Okay. When you get there, depending on what time you arrive, they have...
They're turning them off. They're
okay.
Them off.
They have very... They have various switch, what they call switchbacks or different kinds of lines. And depending on when you get there, I've arrived in Vegas at 8 in the morning and at midnight, and there is planes coming in all the time. Don't worry about being able to get a cab. Do not worry about being able to get an accessible cab. That is their business to get you to your hotel. They don't want you lollygagging around. They want you in the casino spending money. When you get to the airport... there are limousines. The shuttles are $5 one way, $9.75 round trip. The cab is $15 one way. It'll take you about 10 minutes to get there. Just tell the cab driver that you want to go to the Riviera, or just call, or if you want to sound really slick, just say the Riv. And he will not ask you for an address. They don't have, I mean, they have addresses for the mail, but for the cabs, just say the Riv, and it'll take you there. When you get there, this is real important. There are four entrances. The main one on Las Vegas Boulevard, which is where the bus stops, but where the transportation stops, there's three places. One is the convention area. That's where the tours will leave from, and I'll talk to you about that in a second. You don't want to go to the tour, to the convention entrance. There's an there's a parking area below where guests park, where the cabs will go down, also limousines. It's known as the dungeon. Do not go to the dungeon. You want to go to the south entrance, okay? When you get into the cab, say, I want the Riviera South entrance. That is the closest entrance to the front desk. If you go into the dungeon, you'll eventually work your way up to the surface, and you'll eventually get there. If you end up at the convention area, you got to wind all the way through convention. By the time you get to the front desk, you'll be ticked off because you'll say, why they picked this convention? I can't get around. Go to the south entrance. That will be steps away from the front desk. Once you're at the front desk, then there'll be volunteers there. If I want to go back to the airport, Marjorie Beeman, ACB volunteer coordinator extraordinaire, has been working with the airport. As you know, her efforts have been stepped up, and she does her best, but she can only do so much because of 9/11 restrictions. So... bulk of people will be coming in Friday and Saturday. Now, this is one thing that I'm going to step on some toes here, but and this is also in my article, too. When you pack at home and close up that suitcase and zip it up, don't lock it. First of all, do not lock it. They will break your lock if they need to. If they need to get into your suitcase, if something's in there. Executive Director Melanie Brunson just sent out a word over email. If you smokers, do not carry your lighters on you or in your suitcase. You got to buy your lighter when you get to Vegas. They will take it out and they will destroy it. So that's a new one, and that's just come down in the last month or so. But going back to your suitcase, please, there's going to be, again, Las Vegas is like none of, they have, I had been in Japan about three years ago, and one of our interpreters was saying, oh, I'm going to Vegas. She was taking a direct from Tokyo to Vegas. So there are planes that come in from all over the world. When you get there, please don't just say, I have a black suitcase. Everybody on this green earth has a black suitcase. Do something to your suitcase that makes it very identifiable. You can tell the volunteer it's black with a red, white, and blue ACB tag. Of course, that'll be everybody, too. So try to do something that makes it very identifiable. Sometimes, you know, somebody has told you at home, oh, it's got a picture of a, let's say, a bird on the luggage tag. And it turns out it's a very teeny weeny little sketch of a picture up in a corner. Make sure you could feel your suit. You can buy luggage places and buy straps, and you can put colorful straps around it. Those little small pom pom things. You can get fabric ribbon. Anything to really quickly be able to identify your luggage. Okay, got a lot to cover, so. It sounds like they're rebuilding.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I have no idea what that is. It sounds like the elephants in Vegas getting ready for the show.
Yeah, getting ready. Elvis is coming out of his grave or something. The Nevada Council of the Blind has been working very diligently to make sure that when you arrive, that their end of things is going to come to fruition. They have a Welcome to Nevada party that they have been working on. Myself, Carla Rushville, Burl Colley, met with them last weekend, and they are so excited to have you come. I want to say that the pre-registration packet is going to print as we speak. So it should be ready and on the website in the next couple of weeks. As you know, it takes a while to get everything all synchronized. Once it gets put into the mail, it will go up on the website, and so you'll be able to register then. Each year we get more and more and more registrants. Now, this is the one thing that I've been saying as I've been talking to various groups. We all know that Chief Financial Officer Jim Olson has passed away. Jim did things the Jim, his only Jim could do them. Please be patient. Executive Director Melanie Brunson is also supervising the Minneapolis office. But when you come to registration this year, things may not be exactly as Jim would have done them. But they'll be done. You'll get your tickets. And really, life will go on. So please be patient if there's some snafus. But Chris Gray, as he said last night, has put Melanie Brunson in charge of the office. And it is running smoothly. No, we do not have a permanent replacement yet for Jim. Yes, there will be registration and people there. June Horst has worked that. She could work that registration in her sleep. And there's a number of other people that can too. So, but I'm just saying, if something is not exactly as you're used to it or is used to it, well, Jim always did this for me. Jim's not here. And so we're all going to have to be patient with that. There will be, Margie, 5
yes.
Guide dog relief areas. Don't ask me where they are. No.
Don't ask
Margie either. There will be 5 guide dog relief areas, and mainly because the convention area is elongated. Now, this is the nice thing, as many of you know, there's a few rooms that are on what I call upstairs, and I'll talk to you about that in a minute, but 95% of your meeting rooms are on one level.
Yeah. Yeah.
When you walk into the convention area, there is, they call them Capri, in Capri rooms. In the program, if you see Capri 101 or 101, it means the same thing. 101, 102 will be on your left. They're huge rooms. That's where we're going to have the CCLVI dance and some other things. Now, on the right. I'm sorry, I'm left-handed. Everything to me is left. when you turn, when you get into the convention area, the first thing you're going to come to on your left will be registration. Just beyond that will be information. And all down the hallway starts Capri on your right is Capri 101 to 116. All the way down this hallway. On your left is general session. And they're literally like 10 feet apart. So it's going to be interesting when 1,000 people get up this one hallway. So you'll also, too, the grand ballroom, which will be set up with tables, yay, this year, will be on your left. Letters and numbers are on your and big numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, and then 101 to 116 is on the right. Upstairs, there are various resolutions. Will be in 201. Will be in 201. Worked on this. Mississippi University is going to come training. So there are some rooms upstairs accessible via an elevator or steps that are right in going. There's a break in the rooms after room 110. There's kind of a breakthrough way, but it's still on one line. Then across from, oh gosh, I believe it's 111, 112, Royale Pavilion. That's where exhibits will be, all in one line. And exhibit coordinator Mike Smitherman has been, I don't know exactly how many has yet, but if it's any indication from the number I've been contacted, please check it. We should have well over 100 exhibitors. I get one exhibit. I want an exhibit. So, and you will have variety and all kinds of technology. Just, you know, empty your bank accounts and come on down. As I said, the Youth Activity Center, headed by Patty Cox, will be stationed in room 205. She will take kids, blind or sighted, from ages 6 to 17. If they're 18 or older, she'll use them as volunteers. Circus Circus is across the street, and they have a whole playland of miniature golf and aquariums and bumper cars. No, you're not going. And bumper cars. And she's going to take them there. Now, if you really want a thrill, you can go up to the Stratosphere, which is... And you can ride the roller coaster, which takes you, which loops you around on the outside of the Stratosphere. Woohoo! No, I'm not doing that. So, next thing, I've already talked to you about volunteers. Now, a lot of the calls that I've been getting have been of the nature where people are wanting to make sure that they can get to the hotel rooms, I mean to the media rooms. We have picked this hotel specifically because it is easy. It's very nice to navigate. So once you're down that hallway, you'll be fine. Yes, we'll have volunteers stationed at the elevator and in strategic locations. If you are a person that really needs a lot of assistance, I can't guarantee that somebody's always going to be available when you need it. I've had calls for people wanting personal volunteers. I had a call, a lady wanted to pay, so can I just pay them and have them all to myself? And I said, no, you can't do. I said, we did not have this conversation. And so you need to realize that if you need a higher level of assistance, then you may need to make some alternative plans, bring somebody with you, so forth. But somebody, you know, we'll do our best. The American Council of the Blind has some convention guidelines, and if people have been are under the ACB umbrella as volunteers, they're not going to escort you to your sleeping room. There is too much liability. So you need to get yourself to the elevator, get down to the main floor area, and then we will help you. Tours. There will be a maximum of 3 tours on certain days, and that's on the weekends, mostly about 2 tours each day. Tour coordinator Burl Colley has been working to make sure that you have a variety of things to do. I talked with him this morning, and there is a baseball game that people are going to go to. I believe it's on Friday, Las Vegas versus Portland. And there will be a cruise on Wednesday on Lake Mead. That'll be a dinner dance cruise. Also, too, they're going to do a blind services tour. Liberace, Elvis, and Sherry's Ranch. And now, when you go to, I need to tell you about Sherry's Ranch, because people have said, well, you know, should we be doing tours like that? Here's what I say. If you don't want to go, don't buy a ticket. That's what I say. Don't buy a ticket. That's the way to ensure that you won't go. It's a 21 and over older tour, so please keep that in mind as well. It is a working ranch, and I don't mean cattle. Now, if you need the another version, you can talk to me later. But you will be having high tea. There will be a tour. Don't ask me of what. And according to tour coordinator Burl, it'll be audio described.
See, I want to see the souvenir shop in that one.
Woo! All right, I'm gonna tell the Minneapolis office if they see any tickets from CCB, they're to tear them up. That's it. You better behave yourselves. And they will talk to you, and they're part of the tour, they will talk to you about the adult industry. Mm. And there will be the usual city tour and some other tours as well. Now, it's interesting, this year, some side groups, B-Flag is doing a roller coaster tour, the Star Trek group is doing a tour across the street to the Hilton, to their Star Trek area, so there are some non-ACB sponsored tours as well that you might want to be a part of. A couple other things, and then I'll take questions. Do you like hot butter popcorn?
Oh, yeah.
Ice cream bars? Hot dogs? These are going to be some of the items that will be in the ACB Cafe. The ACB Cafe this year will be open from 7:30 to 3:30. From 7:30 to 9:30 will be breakfast. From 9:30 to 11:30, you can go in there for snacks, the ice cream bars, the pretzels, candy bars. It'll be like our own little 7-Eleven. From 11:30 to 1:30 will be lunch items, and those will be, they're going to change them up each day, but they're going to be, you know, hot dogs, salads, hamburgers, kind of the traditional kinds of lunch things. And then from 1:30 to 3:30, again, it'll be snack items. There will be tables in there where you can sit. They will bag them up. If you remember Pittsburgh, they put everything in handled bags with handles. And they're going to do that. It is in room H. Room H is directly across from room 109, 110. So that gives you a location of it. Huge room, almost the size of this room. So you're going to go in, and on the right will be on the left will be all the tables of food. It is cash only. Cash only. You cannot charge it. You cannot charge it to your room. You cannot beg, plead, borrow, steal, or cry. It is cash only. And I'll talk about that in a minute. Somebody asks if there's an ATM machine. So you'll go up the line. You can sit there. Over on the right will be some larger tables. Right now we do have plans to have electricity there. If your batteries are low and you need to recharge, we're thinking, we're hopefully, you need to recharge. And we're hoping, if it doesn't cost too much, to get internet access in there too. So you can, if you have a laptop or whatever, you can get on the internet and so forth. The way that you will know where that room is, besides it's across from 109, 110, is that there'll also be some lightly music being piped in, and of course you'll smell the popcorn in the afternoons. So that is something that has been worked on. Let me talk to you a little bit, and then I'll take some questions, because I know we're running behind schedule. People have been asking me, what about the casino? What about the gambling? What about all of those kinds of things? And what I've been saying to people, and please don't misunderstand me, I understand people want to gamble and have fun in the evening times as well. I have just as many responsibilities in Vegas as I did in Birmingham, Pittsburgh, Houston, my three previous conventions. The added dimension, of course, here is that there are casinos. What I've been doing is I've been working with the hotels. They've hosted the blinded veterans there many times. So they are, this is another reason that we selected them. They're not novice to having blind people around. And so we're working with them and we're going to be talking to the dealers about with the blackjack and so on. Now I've heard about, you know, what about these machines? They don't spit out any money. Well, Carla and I, oh, I'm sorry, we're supposed to be working. Carla and I ended, well, it was real late. It was after we put all the rooms in, after we set all the meetings. And we, ended up at one of those machines that just spits out paper. Yes, it has writing on it, but it still makes noise. It still, you know, goes, wheel, oh, fortune. And it still makes these, yeah, and all these sounds. It still does that. So if you happen to be at one, it will spit out a piece of paper, and it'll, yes, it's all just print, and it'll tell you, you know, take it to the cashier and get, you know, whatever money is that you have. Please remember that our volunteer resources are going to be for the meeting rooms specifically. We'll see what we can do about the casino areas. But, again, please keep in mind that it's like any other convention with this other added dimension, and we're going to try and put what resources we can. But our main goal is to make sure that you get to and from your meetings and the places that you need to be. Just a couple of little things. When you register, we are trying to principally put people in two towers, the Monte Carlo or the Monaco. The hotel has 5 towers comprising 2,000 sleeping rooms, of which ACB will have about 800 in the Monaco and the Monte Carlo. These are the two towers closest to the sleeping room, closest to the meeting rooms. The Riviera is one of the oldest hotels on the Strip. It was built in the 1950s, and each of these towers have been added on at various times. In my article and in the program will be noted which towers are numbered which. For example, the Monte Carlo is numbered rooms 1,500 to 2,900. So if you're in room 1,501, you're on the first sleeping floor of the Monte Carlo. The Monaco is numbered rooms 4,200 to 6,400. Yes, it's quite tall. That's principally where most of you will be, in the Monaco. And so if you're on the 42nd floor, you're on the first floor of their sleeping area. The other three towers, just so you know, are the San Remo, Mediterranean North, and Mediterranean South. Their numbering system will also be in the program. Some of you may end up there. Doesn't mean you can't move later. But see, the more specific you get about your room, see, this is what happens. People call and they say, I need a king non-smoking, or I need a double non-smoking room. And maybe they have king non-smoking rooms or some other kind of configuration, but you have specified double non-smoking, and they'll say, no, we don't have any. Then you'll call me and you'll say, the hotel's out of rooms, and I'll call back and I'll say, no, they're not. So just kind of like you do with the airlines when you call and they say, well, here's the seat, it's going to cost this much. You say, well, can you get me on another flight, or can you get me in another time period? Say that if you haven't called yet. What else do you have? Oh, well, we have non-smoking king. We have non-smoking what? Oh, that'll be fine. So be a little diligent. Don't just, because you've been so specific, they'll just say, no, we don't have that. So that's another thing. And you might end up, because of that, in San Remo, in Mediterranean North or Mediterranean South. Doesn't mean you can't move later. Doesn't mean the rates will be any different, $77 a night plus tax, which will end up about $85 a night. But it does mean that you may not be principally in those two. I will work my darndest to make sure that you are. Now, they can't tell you exactly where you're going to be, but once you get there and you end up in another one of the other three towers, then just ask them, can I be on the wait list, or can you let me know when I can move? And I think that's pretty much, before I take any questions, I think that's pretty much what I have. President Gray talked to you about the general session and that program. of course, Dave Williams is doing streaming on, you know, over ACB radio. We'll have the communication center, and things will go well. We've lost a couple of great members in Jim and Gail, and we've lost some in our state, and then I've heard the list the other day from yours. But we owe it to those that have passed on to make this the greatest convention ever and to do it in their wonderful names. Thank you very much, and I will take questions.
For those of you wanting to ask questions, we're just going to take a couple of minutes because we are running late, but please get yourselves to a microphone quickly. And Ed is going to try a wireless mic to see how that'll work. So if you at least raise your hand, that'll be fine. I guess from what Ed's saying, he put his roller skates on.
Oh, let me give you the 800 number if you have not made your reservations. 800-634-6753. Please say American Council of the Blind. They have tons of conventions every weekend. Don't just say ACB, please.
Okay. Cynthia Margie Donovan, and I just want to add a couple comments as a guide dog representative since California does have a lot of handlers. In addition to there being five relieving areas, there are a couple very critical things to know. One is I personally recommend, this is not a requirement, but if you're coming with a dog, I personally recommend you stay in the Monaco Tower. And I'm not going to go into all the details why, because it's a very massive complex that basically the inside is lush greenery and pool and nowhere to relieve the dogs, and that's the closest to the main relieving area. If you're staying in the Monaco, which you can't help if you have a suite because that's where it is, you have about a block walk to get outside. You also should be very cautious this year to know, and it's in my article, which will be out in the June form. Unlike previous years, you know, Vegas being a 24-hour city and being a tourist city, they have tons of security. The hotel will be charging for people using the greenery, the grass, any of that. The hotel security will be adding a charge to the room. And that is because they spend lots of money. And once you get there, you'll realize it. On the center court of all the towers where there's tons of beautiful grass, there's hundreds of sunbathers sitting around the pool. So not an ideal area to relieve your dog. And outside of that, there really isn't any other areas than what we've designated. And we've tried to put them in strategic locations, but I just want to give you a heads up on that in terms of the Monaco Tower. If you're not going to use a suite, I really recommend that you stay in that tower. Now, somebody just asked, where is that in proximity to the Monte Carlo and the activities? It doesn't matter. They're equally spread apart to the activities. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. We're going to try two real quick questions, okay. And if they have to be quick.
Okay, this is Lorraine Brown, Silicon Valley. I have a question. I'm staying at my daughter's and taking the paratransit, which I have found out is $4 each way if you're going to the Strip. It's more than the normal price, but it is because of the traffic. My question is, where do I get dropped off in order to come to the convention part?
The paratransit may or may not have designated spots. I know the buses stop on Las Vegas Boulevard. If you can direct the paratransit to where to come, I'd say the convention center, the convention entrance. Because you're not needing to check in.
Right.
So I would just direct them to the convention entrance.
And that's what I call it, the convention.
Yes.
Thank
yes.
you.
Lorraine, actually, I would probably call your local paratransit now, get the number for the Las Vegas,
and
call them and ask ahead of time. That way you already have the knowledge.
Cool. Thanks.
Thank you.
Who is the keynote speaker?
The question is, who is the keynote speaker? We are still working on getting some confirmations. And so I don't want to divulge that just yet. I don't want to say it's Margie Donovan, and then it's going to end up being, you know, Jeff Tom. Oh, okay. She's not.
Folks, I know we have a lot of questions, but we really have to cut it because we are running short on time.
I'm going to be here throughout the remainder of the convention. I'll be at the banquet this evening, and I'll be here through your business session. And I'm going to have to figure out what to do about the water, too, because my plane doesn't leave till 3:30.
Well, we'll see. And Cynthia, if Las Vegas doesn't hire you as a tour
administrator after this. They're crazy. Thanks so much.
Thank
we really
you, everybody.
Appreciate it. Okay, before we do our next presentation, they're getting ready, but I want to introduce Roger Peterson. He's our Bylaws and Constitution Chair, and he would like to present an amendment. Roger?
Ira, come down and under. Come on.
Oh, there it is. Hello, Mike. Okay. This is what we're doing here is the preliminary reading, because when we act on a constitutional amendment, we have to read it one day and act on it the next day. So here's what's happening. This has to do with the issue that has been mentioned to the Constitution Committee about the problem of chapters that may or may not have a majority of blind members. What we propose to do about that, and we got into all kinds of stuff about whether we should define blindness and all that. We decided that we're not ready to do that. But what we propose to do is the following. Section 8.3. I'm going to read the section as it is first. A chapter's privileges and duties as an affiliate of the California Council of the Blind shall be as set forth in this Constitution and the Council bylaws. And this next part is part we added a couple of years ago. Any chapter not retaining at least 10 members for 2 consecutive years shall be deemed inactive and shall lose its privilege to vote at the council convention. At this time, the board of directors may consider the withdrawal of the chapter's charter. All members of such a chapter shall retain their privileges of membership in the council and shall become members at large in the case of withdrawal of a charter. Now, what we proposed to run by you as a possibility is that in that part where it says any chapter that any chapter not retaining at least 10 members for 2 consecutive years, we propose the possibility of adding to that after the word members, or whose blind members fail to constitute a majority of its membership, and then continuing on, for 2 consecutive years shall be deemed inactive, and so on and so on. So what we're proposing is just adding, in addition to the possibility of becoming inactive because you don't have 10 members, you could because you don't have a majority of blind members. That's it, and that's what we're doing, and we'll talk about it tomorrow. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Roger, and we will hear more on this tomorrow, and tomorrow would be the time to vote on that. So gives you some time to think. We have a really, they're up here. We'll do one just to relax everyone. But it sounds like nobody wants a door prize. All right. So the first time I've ever been wrong.
Not according to your wife.
Oh, well. See what happens when I'm not in the audience with her? Okay, we're going to do a door prize. Let's see what we have for a door prize. Ed? Yeah, something really good that I want to win again.
Money.
Well, I won C's candy last night.
We have Building Blocks to Success, looks like tapes by Artist Basin, and $25 from Greater LA.
$25 from Greater LA and Building Blocks to Success, the book, and it's on tape, by written by Artis Bazin. And let's see what kind of a name we get. Dan Kaiser, are you in the room?
Yeah.
Well,
Dan,
you've only had one way to success. Now you'll have 26.
25 is definitely a building block.
25 additional. All right, very good. All right, we'll do another one later. $25? I'm not sure. It really gives me a great pleasure to introduce our next panel that's going to be speaking on welfare services and its impact on blind parents. And to do this for us, we have two people that are very much involved in exactly this type of role in many ways. Marjorie Donovan, who is Visual Impairment Services Team Coordinator, San Francisco Veterans Affairs in San Francisco Medical Center, and also Melinda Lake, who is the Redesign Program Manager for the Department of Health and Human Services Child Protective Services Division in Sacramento. And Sacramento County, I believe?
Yes.
Sacramento. And with that, I'm going to turn it over first to Margie. And thank you. And welcome.
Thank you, Ken. Is this working? Great. Everybody can hear me. Usually people don't have that problem. You might wonder how I got involved with this, given that I work for the VA. And most veterans don't have small kids or kids under the age of 18, and some of you know. Whatever the date was, it was the first Saturday in December of 04. I got a call at 8 o'clock that morning from Ron and Lisa Brooks. Many of you know them. They used to live in California. And they had just gotten an SOS over the internet from a blind couple who just gave birth to a beautiful, healthy baby boy the day before, and CPS was there to take away their child. Fortunately, I happened to be home because the incident was taking place in Redwood City, and I live very close to there in Burlingame. Now, I'm going to tell you the sequence of events for that day, and I'm going to tell you it with the intent of education, not invoking anger. It's history. It's done. It's in the legal process. But the steps that were taken that day, I believe, were obviously very successful steps taken that resulted in baby Rivaldo going home with his parents at 9 o'clock Saturday evening. So I get this call, and I go into madness mode, being a parent myself, and also remembering back when I gave birth to my son in 1986, that this fear was kind of in the back of my head, CPS. Now, fortunately, I think CPS didn't get involved because I happened to be married to a sighted man at that time. But I'm just curious, by a quick clap, how many people in the audience have kids? How many of you have ever feared CPS's involvement because you were blind? So about half of you.
More than fear, they did it.
That's okay, right. I'm just talking to fear. I was going to get to that. How many of you have had CPS intervene because you were blind? So a few. Now, when you look at that percentage compared to the average sighted world, or if this was a sighted audience, I bet you're only going to have a few that had the fear of CPS. And I bet of those few, you're only going to have a couple at the best that had CPS involved. I will say there are positive stories about CPS that I personally experienced myself when a neighbor turned me in for throwing furniture at my son, which wasn't true. It was a dog bone at the dog. But that was a very positive experience. So CPS is not always bad. As a matter of fact, they're there for the interest of the child. And I felt that very strongly when they intervened on my behalf and clearly within a couple hours closed the case out unfounded. But they had to come out because they got a complaint or they got a concern. So the intent of CPS is really there to help your kid. Now, however, that is not what took place in the Zepeda family's case. So after getting that call, the first call was to CPS. And let me tell you, don't even bother. Don't even bother trying to talk to them, even if the family's on the phone, because they're not going to talk to you. And by law, they can't. And I know that. Okay, they don't even know that it was Mrs. Zapata on the phone with me when I three-wayed her to the worker. They have no idea. So that's just a waste of time. As quickly as you can, get your butt to the hospital. And I was very fortunate that my partner is sighted, and because it wouldn't have been easy to get there, but I would have taken a cab. It would have been about $60, and it would have been worth every penny of it. But thank God he was there. The first decision in my head was, do I take my dog? I thought, yeah, let's see them try to throw me out with my dog. My concern then became, once I get there, it was obvious I needed to stay in that room and not leave that room for any reason. Well, fortunately, my partner was there, and I'd call him up on the cell phone. He stayed in the lobby for 9 hours, bringing me food, coming to get my dog, and walking my dog. So I don't know that I could have done it without him, but somehow it would have worked. So here's a picture. I said to myself, I'm going to the hospital. On the way to the hospital, I called Chris Gray, and I called Jeff Tom, both of whom already were aware of this situation, but not how far it had advanced. I told Chris Gray, I said, I'm going to stay there as long as I need to get that baby out of there. I said, your job is to contact the media. That's where the pressure hits. And let me tell you, ACB did a knockout job. A knockout job. Within minutes after I arrived at the hospital, the San Jose Mercury was there in the room. So picture this. I'm a professional with a master's degree, working in a medical center myself for 15 years. I know something about medical centers. I'm a professional in the field of blindness with the rehab teaching. And I have a 18-year-old son who's now in college and an Eagle Scout. So I'm going in going, oh, this is a piece of cake. They're going to listen to me. Wrong. Wrong. So my first step, as I'm telling the blindness community, calm down. We don't know what the situation is. We don't know if these people can take care of a child. We should never assume because you're blind you can or because you're blind you can't. So I said, you know, the rehab teacher, no biggie. I'll walk in and I'll assess it. Well, within 5 minutes, it was blatantly obvious that they had prepared even better than me. It was very obvious. The one thing they did wrong was they asked the social worker, upon discharge, can I get a visiting nurse to come look at my baby for a couple days, make sure it doesn't have jaundice? Well, very common request. However, that hospital social worker had no clue what to do, supposedly tried to get a hold of some agencies, was not successful, including the Peninsula Center of the Blind and Visually Impaired, was not successful, called CPS, because, and I do believe this is very true, CPS in San Mateo County is often a resource, okay? So the social worker at the hospital, Nancy, called CPS. Now, my first question is, if you called CPS as a resource, why did you divulge the patient's name? Which they couldn't answer. Anyway, getting back into the line of things. So I assessed the parents, no problem. The CPS said they had no family support, a lie. 15 people were in that room when I walked in that room, church members and family members. There happened to be another blind lady and her husband, who happened to be a pastor in that room, Heidi Joshi, and her husband, Montoon Joshi. Joshi. And Heidi is an MFCC, and Heidi is getting her clinical psychology degree. So we were a hit team. And I'm telling you, we were a great hit team. And her husband brought his laptop. So we found out that the Zapata family had signed away the rights to put the baby in foster home on Friday. But they did this not realizing, okay? Number one, they're both Hispanic-speaking. English is not their native language. And they were scared. The father was made to demonstrate changing diapers. How many of you fathers knew how to change diapers? My question is, why not the mother? So we realize they signed away their rights. So while we're waiting for this team meeting to take place, which supposedly was going to happen between 10 and 11, that took place at 1 o'clock, which was wonderful. It gave us plenty of time. We wrote out a recension document. The nurses at the hospital, wonderful, they copied it. So when this team came in, the CPS social worker, the hospital social worker, and the lead nurse, we had this document that was signed by both of the parents and two witnesses that rescinded the document that they had signed the day before, explaining that it was not provided to them in their language of choice and it was not provided to them in an accessible format. So now picture this. They walk in. We got all these documents. I stand up. I introduce myself. I'm given my business card, and I give them the document. I said, the first thing I would like is for you guys to read this and make sure if you have any questions, you ask me. Well, they came back. They go, we need you to know. I said, no, I don't need to know anything. It's very obvious to me. It's blatant discrimination. And the social worker at the hospital said, it's not discrimination, blah, blah, blah. Same old stuff we hear all the time. So I got them to agree that they understood, and them voluntarily handing their son over to protective custody was not going to be. And they totally agreed with that and said, okay, we want to make a plan for the care of the son. So I challenged them a little, but keeping in mind, as I told the Zapatas when I walked in the room, we're not going to face head on the discrimination. It's not time to do it. Your goal is to get out of here and get out today and get out with your son. Thank you. Oh, my God, I'm running out of time. And that was our full goal. So you know how when we get discriminated against, we want to be in people's face and push? Don't push CPS. You'll never win. Negotiate. And the first thing you want to do is get that baby home with the parents. I don't care if you have to have the social worker staying at the house. So that was our goal. That's what we worked towards. And the long haul of the story is that what we got. And one little aside here, the social worker, the team, we'll call it, came back in after speaking with the supervisor social worker on duty and said, we've got three choices. Choice number one is to keep mom and baby in the hospital to Monday till the main social worker can get on the case and we could get a plan. And I came back. I said, what plan? I said, well, we need a plan for the safety of the baby. I said, is the baby's health in danger? They said, no. I said, is the baby at risk of being exploited? No. Is the baby at risk of being neglected? No. Then what's the issue? Discrimination, right? No. We've got to have a plan for the health and safety of the baby. So here's where my hospital stuff came in. I said, well, you know, keeping people in the hospital beyond the mandatory medical necessity is putting people at risk for illness and even death. I said, so you're asking this newborn baby to be in the hospital for two more days when the pediatrician cleared him. I was there when the pediatrician cleared the baby and the OBGYN cleared the mom. I said, so you're worried about the blind parents, but you want to put the baby at risk. Well, they couldn't say a thing. So that threw them into a tailspin because I said, this is absolutely not going to happen. By the way, first thing in the morning, both parents designated Heidi and I to be their spokesperson for that day. So the little team went out, had a little powwow, came back in, gave option number one again. I just stood there and I said, that's not acceptable. Option number two was to go home and have somebody stay with you for the weekend. Option number three was to go home and have somebody check in on you every 1 to 2 hours. We were prepared for option three. Why they had their powwows, we had our powwows. Because we knew they were not going to get out of it without having somebody look in on them, but we had to buy a day or so. So we took option three. We already had people prepared to sign documents that said they would do that. And they were very fortunate. Their apartment manager, who was at the hospital all day, lovely lady, is a certified nurse assistant, ran care homes before, and lived right in the building. So she had a very willing to sign a document to check in on them, and the aunt of the couple signed a document. Now here comes the kicks. Just to get the discrimination in there, Once everything was finalized, then the team itself had to go out and create their own document and bring it back. And every time they left the room, we're strategizing again. I said, I'm going to tell you guys something. They're going to come back. They're going to want you to sign this stuff. And it's not going to be in Braille. And it's not going to be in Spanish. I said, but let's ask. So when they came in with their documents, I said, do you have these documents in Spanish? They said, no. I said, do you have an interpreter? They said, no. I said, you're required by law to have an interpreter. I said, well, that's okay. The aunt's here, and she speaks really good English. She'll interpret it. So we had our plan. Then we said, can you provide these documents in Braille? They said, no. I said, well, I was prepared for that. I said, can you at least give it to them on a computer disk so they can go home and review what they signed? Oh, I don't know how to do that. I said, well, do you use email? They said, yeah. I said, well, why don't you go email it to them? Well, I'm not sure I can do that. So I just calmly said, once again, you're asking them to sign a document that you're not providing to them in accessible format, and we're going to do it because we want to take the baby home. So I had the parents write. Now, this is where the race comes in, the ethnicity comes in. I told the mom, she was prepared, that when she had to sign the document after the aunt read it to her, to say to me, say, Margie, would you please add the statement we talked about? So I said to the aunt, I said, please write the following. We, the parents of Rivaldo Zepeda, under duress, and the social worker goes, what do you mean, duress? And I said, these parents are clearly under duress. And the social worker says, and I quote her, Adelina, do you even know what duress means? And I turned to the social worker, and I said, would you like me to get the attorney on the phone? No, I can't speak with any attorneys. I said, then I'm going to continue dictating, and the parents are going to sign the statement, and you cannot prevent this. And so I continued dictating, and the parents signed it, and the social worker was not happy. And one more bomb came, but we were fully prepared for it. The social worker had to go out to the home and do a home inspection. And we were prepared. So Adelina said, when she said that, she says, Margie, here's the keys. I want you to go with her. What happened to me that the apartment manager was back at the apartment on site. We made a call, and she went with her. The social worker came back and cleared everything. Absolutely everything. Now, they're going home to a studio apartment with a newborn baby. They labor for 72 hours, gave birth. I forgot what time on Friday morning. It's now 8 o'clock Saturday night, and I had gotten there about 10 o'clock Saturday morning. And media was ringing telephones, knocking at doors, and everything. And remember, when they went home with that baby, the case was not closed. Okay? It was just an interim agreement to get us till Monday. By Monday, we had contacted an attorney at Dreddiff Disability Rights that I used to work with many, many years ago in high school. By Sunday night, Arlene called me at home. Arlene Marison happened to also know the lead counsel for the city of San Mateo. This is all over the newspaper, all over the television. She kindly called him at home. He was not aware of it. So, needless to say, they, first thing Monday morning, got on the fast track. Arlene made it real clear they were not to go out to the Zepeda's home. The CPS wasn't. Well, the CPS showed up because they hadn't gotten a word from county council. And the apartment manager wouldn't tell them what apartment they lived in, so they left. In the meanwhile, the attorneys working with CPS and ACB's public affairs people are working with a couple national television shows. All day Sunday, all day Monday, I'm over at the Zepeda's. We're interviewed by tons of media, and now it's starting to go nationally, NPR. And I'm basically the buffer, and this is very important for people to keep in mind if you ever help and the media gets involved. They need a buffer to decide for them. They are emotionally raw. They're still terrified of their baby being removed, but we have to keep it in the public eye. But you cannot grant every interview that you want to grant and that they, that the media is there. Tuesday morning, the attorney shows up to their house, and remember this, because we go, what? The Scott Peterson trial was two blocks away. Every national media network was camped out in front of their apartment building, wanting an interview. The attorney gets out of the car, and they jump her. Do you know the Zepetis? Do you know the Zepetis? So they went up. She went up, talked to them. They called me. I was finally back at work. And we grant the Zepetis came downstairs. We granted one final interview. And CPS still hadn't closed the case. And I'm working with Arlene and the parents, and we're ready to go on the Today Show at 5 o'clock Wednesday morning. At 8 o'clock Tuesday night, they faxed over to Arlene a document stating the case was closed and unfounded. So, the key here in summarizing, wrapping it up, be on your toes, set every emotion aside, have a wonderful bag full of tricks. Have people you can call on, people that are parents, people that are lawyers. Have your network, even if you think you may not get that call. Have information. And the best thing you could shoot for is getting the baby and mom out of the hospital together and not into CPS hands. It's going to be under CPS guidance. You're not going to get away from that without getting an attorney involved in most cases. Now, CPS and the hospital made a number of wrong moves there, and things should have been handled differently. There are procedures in place for handling differently, but some things should have gone. And what kind of procedures definitely are in place is Melinda.
Thank you, Margie. Can you hear me, Kay? Okay. My name is Melinda Licker for over 17 years. I started as a social worker. I'm a manager with the. And I really thank you for inviting me here today. I welcome the opportunity to talk to you about our system and how it's designed to work for the benefit of children and families. We do this all the time. We're groups. And you may ask why. And being about our agency, there are a lot of fears about Child Protective Services. So we do go out and provide information about how the agency works and what our objectives are. Later tonight, I'll be speaking to Slavic parents on the north end of town, so we really are out there quite a lot. I wanted to start really with the mission statement for Child Protective Services.
Yeah, that noise is really horrible.
Did the band come back?
There's actually a drumming group on the mall that is performing.
Well, that's a first for me.
Yeah. We're waiting for smoke signals.
Just eat the mic.
Okay. There we go. I'm not quite used to the mic. Our mission statement in Sacramento County for Child Protective Services is that we strive to achieve the well-being of children in our community by first protecting our children and strengthening our families, providing permanent homes and building community partnerships, and that we are committed to providing service with integrity and respect for the diversity of our community. And California has a vision statement. You know there are 58 counties in California, and there's 58 different ways of providing services sometimes in California. But with the work that's going on within the state to improve our services, we have one state vision statement for the children of California, and that is that every child in California lives in a safe, stable, permanent home nurtured by healthy families and strong communities. So what is Child Protective Services, and how is it supposed to work? I think everyone knows that the system starts with a call to the hotline. In Sacramento, that number is 875-KIDS. And I wanted to share with you that in Sacramento County last year, we assessed 21,409 reports of suspected child abuse and neglect. So there's a lot of concern out there about children's safety. And we invite those calls because sometimes children are in very perilous situations, and we invite persons of who have concerns to call and consult about the situation. When the calls do come in, those are routed to trained social workers. They may have a bachelor's degree or a master's degree in social work. And at our hotline, that social worker will assess the presenting information. They'll listen to what the concern is. And I mentioned improvement efforts to improve the system. There are quite a bit going on right now. And one of those is to really look at building in more of a strength-based approach to working with families. And that's starting even at the hotline. It's been a pretty deficit-based system in the sense that we're focusing on problems. Tell me about the problem. Tell me more about the problem. Now, in Sacramento County, as well as in other counties, we are beginning to ask about, tell me what's going right for the family. There may be this concern or problem, but what are the strengths in this family that you see? What kind of organizations is the family already involved with that could help with this problem? And what do you think the needs are for this family? So even at the first call now, we're looking at the family strengths to help us better assess the situation with the family. Also, with the new improvements in the system, we have now the opportunity to do a little more prevention work with our families. Sometimes, well, in Sacramento, 17% of our calls do not meet the criteria for a response. That doesn't always mean that there's no concern. It's just not serious enough for an agency response. And so what has been our practice is to close that case or that call with no action taken. That may sound like a good idea, but in some cases that concern can brew and get a little bit worse until now the situation does require more government intervention. So what we wanted to do was design a system that allowed for prevention. When those low-level problems come to our attention, now we have partnerships in our community so that we can refer that family over to that community-based organization who can provide the supports and services that the family needs at the time when they need them, when they first come to the attention, and address those problems. We also have redesigned our system so that for some of the situations that come to our attention that are not serious or severe, we're able to partner at the first phone call and respond together to the family so that the agency is no longer going out by itself but with a community partner to assess the situation that had been reported. We're doing enhanced assessments with safety and risk, and those, again, are through the child welfare improvement redesign that's underway so that we actually get as much information as possible at the time of the assessment with the family. So we're talking with the family. We're inviting others to be there when we meet with the family. In fact, one of the practice changes that we've just implemented here in Sacramento was to change our procedure of showing up unannounced. You may have heard stories about social workers knocking on the door or going to the schools first and seeing the children there. Now in the new system, in, again, a strength-based family engagement model, we're calling the family before we visit anybody, giving that parent a call, letting them know there had been a report of concern, and we'd like to make an appointment to come and talk with you, and encouraging the family to include others to be there at the home, whether it's their other family members or friends or their support through the clergy or the church. Anyone who may be of support to that family is invited to be there when we visit. So, again, we can receive the most comprehensive information. And that's all through the new redesign. Through those assessments, the agency is charged with looking at, is there imminent danger or risk to the child? If there is, a safety plan will need to be developed. We're also looking at risk. There may not be imminent danger, but what's the risk of future harm to the child? And depending on the results of those assessments and the information gleaned, plans may be developed to strengthen the family. And it used to be in the old system that the social worker would kind of go away and maybe talk to their supervisor and come up with their plan, what they thought would help the family. In the new redesign, we're working at that kitchen table. with the church, with the family, with the friends and the relatives to develop the plan together. Because who knows the family best? The family. And so there's movement to move to a very inclusive planning process to develop the plan, case plans when they do become necessary. There's also new strategies in place to work more with teams. Again, like I mentioned, inviting folks to be a part of the first meeting, but any additional meetings that may need to occur, inviting others to be part of that so that the best decision possible can be made. And that's a big change for Child Protective Services. We've been used to working alone. Now we're working with teams. Sometimes folks want to know what the numbers are, you know, because we most times when you think about Child Protective Services, you are thinking about those cases that hit the news. The cases that do result in having children removed. Now, I mentioned, what was the number? I think it was 21,409 reports last year. How many resulted in removal? 3%. So 3% of the reports that come to our attention here in Sacramento result in removal. What we really are trying to do is work with that work with the population to get them linked into services so that 89% of the cases that came to our attention last year were referred to services in the community. And 6% received a voluntary service plan with the agency. And I want to stress voluntary because that's exactly what it is. And it's a short term. It can be up to 6 months to help the family with whatever a situation they're going through at the time. Even when children are removed, that 3%, the case doesn't end there. Immediately, we're working again with the families to determine what services can be put in place to get that child home with its own parents as soon as possible. And if removal does have to occur, we are looking diligently to those relatives and friends to place the child with them if that were to become necessary. So that's a little bit about how the system gets started and that first response that occurs with the family, and a little bit about the improvements that are underway, not only here in Sacramento, but there are 10 other counties who have volunteered to be first in California to try out these new ways of responding to families, to be more engaging, to work more with teams, and to practice strategies that are frankly more respectful, calling families up and giving them asking for an appointment rather than seeing their children at school, and then knocking on the door and wondering why people are angry and not willing to talk with us. So those practices are underway here in 10 other counties and in other pioneer counties throughout our state as well. So we're doing this because we recognize our system needs to be improved. It was under Governor Davis in 2000 that a group of stakeholders was brought together to look at our system and to be honest about what is wrong with the system and what do we need to change about it. They started that process in 2000, and we got busy planning in 2003 and 4, and now we're getting ready. We're implementing some of these things and moving full steam ahead in 2005, looking at a 5 to 10 year plan to really reshape child welfare here in California to better serve our citizens. That's the information I wanted to give. And Margie wants to say something. Maybe we can take a few questions if we have time, Jeff.
We really don't have any time for questions.
I'll be here through the evening, so if you have any questions. But I do want to say this. Just like we in CCB and ACB, direct, if you will, state rehab, have directed the banking industry on talking ATMs, and now directing the retail industry on point-of-sales machines, it's just as important for each of us to go home, contact our county welfare department, find out what plan they have in place to serve people with kids where the parents are blind, see if you guys can help them develop a plan, see if you guys can educate, because As all discrimination takes place, it's a lack of education. And that's clearly what the situation was in behalf of Sequoia Hospital and San Mateo County CPS. And as part of the litigation, we are developing curriculum and a training module that is mandatory, but we can only do it, of course, for that hospital and that county. So I'm asking each of you to go home and take this on, even if you don't have kids, you don't want kids, you don't like kids. Do it for the sake of the blind parents. Thank you.
Thank you.
What? What was that?
If somebody wanted to get a hold of you, how would they go about getting a hold of you?
Okay. I can be reached by telephone, at work, at 415-750-6604. I can be reached at email at all lowercase, M-A-R-G-I-E, Margie.Donovan, D-O-N-O-V-A-N, at med, M-E-D, like medical center, M-E-D, dot V-A, Veterans Affairs, that stands for, dot gov. You're welcome. Thank you.
Thanks again. Really appreciate the... The fine, fine talk from both of you. Thank you. Speaking of fine talks, we're going to have another one coming up. And you know, this person that's going to speak, I usually tease him a lot, and all. We've known each other a long time, but I'll tell you, this guy does a whole lot of work, and he's been extremely busy on the behalf of CCB, all of us, and all blind people in California and beyond. It gives me great pleasure to introduce our next speaker, Mr. Dan Kaiser, who will give you a report, and he is our Governmental Affairs Director. Dan.
Thank you. I'm not used to Ken being serious.
Wow. The drums got to me.
Yeah, those drums really, it started raining since they played the drums, I noticed, so that's kind of interesting. Oh, it did? Okay. So much for my theory. I want to take this time to first thank my Governmental Affairs Chair, Catherine Skivers, who I'm constantly learning from. And she provides me excellent information and advice, because sometimes I tend to go bullheaded, and she says, Dan, stop, think about it. And that's really helpful, because as we know, sometimes in this child protective situation, we need to sometimes react really quick, and sometimes it's not good to react really quick. And I'd also like to thank my boss, Jeff Tom, who since the beginning, when I started at CCB, I have learned so much. So I appreciate your comments last night, Jeff, but really I've learned so much from you. I wouldn't be the person I am with the knowledge I have today without Jeff Tom, because I know I've learned so much about the legislative process. So let me get on with my report. First, I think the real issues that confront Californians today and confront all blind people is the threat to SSI. We know that right now in the federal government, Congress, in the conference committee, there is a resolution that will cut billions from SSI. You need to, as soon as you get home, you need to contact your congressperson and let them, and your two state senators, Barbara Boxer and Dianne Feinstein, know that you cannot get any more cuts to your SSI SSP. This is very serious, it's very real, and it's happening now. We hope this won't happen with ACB and the CCB working on this. There will be some information that will come down the pike as to what the resolution number is. Chris Gray in the room? Okay. I don't have the resolution number as of Friday when I came over here, but we should have it Monday, and we'll get the word out. We have an 800 line now that you, on the 800 line where you hear the connection, there is another option on there for legislation. And, all chapters, have liaisons, all chapters have representatives, I hope, that keep track of local and federal legislation and state legislation. Listen to that number. We have been real lucky again this year to get some fine legislators behind some of our resolutions, and hopefully we'll get them put into law. Our first bill we have here was originally a cell phone bill, but everybody dropped the cell phone part. But it's very important that we extend the termination date of the deaf and disabled telecommunications program. Because we have many, this is a telephonic system that comes out of surcharges on your telephone bill. Everybody pays half a cent, 1 cent, whatever, on these various programs, like the California Telephone Access Project program, like the California Relay Service for the Deaf 711, and like the telephonic reader. So that's SB 210 by Senator Deborah Bowen. This bill will be passed its first committee unanimously. In fact, we had two Republicans move the bill and second it. And so we have total support, bipartisan support on that bill. Our other bill came out of a resolution last spring where we had a bill years ago, AB 550 by Sam Farr, which we were trying to require 20% of all boards of directors for agencies for the blind to receive rehab money to have blind and visually impaired people on their board, because, you know, we want consumer representation on these boards. We have a bill number. It's SB 1114, and this bill is by the Senate Human Services Committee. It's a committee bill. This bill should be heard next month. It has a lot of support. There's no opposition to the bill as of now. We were instrumental in having an author withdraw a very dangerous bill. That was SB 810 by Jackie Speer, which would have allowed cars to park on sidewalks. And we were outraged when we heard this. And the disability community, led by the CCB, yet again, stood up, rose up, and wrote letters, and they withdrew the bill. Sometimes we feel like David and Goliath, you know. There's two bills that threaten to impact BEP vendors, blind business enterprise vendors. The vending machine bill is back again this year. Requires 50% of all the machines and all the product in every machine in the state buildings to be nutritious. And the vendors feel it's a restriction of trade because they're already in a private setting. And, you know, everybody knows if the customers don't like the food and the vendors have, they go out to the food machine, to the food trucks. Another bill, that's SB 522 by Tom Torlakson. Another bill that threatens the blind vendors is AB 468 by John Campbell. This bill would privatize the roadside rest stops. We don't want to go down the slippery slope and impact our blind and lose the many programs within the BEP we fought hard for years. So we're opposing that bill and the other bill too. Let's go down the list because some of these bills have been withdrawn. There's two bills that relate to weakening the ADA. AB 20 by Tim Leslie. It gets rid of the monetary settlements from ADA cases, has as its remedy not the monetary, but for technical ADA violations are for injunctive relief, which means that they have to correct what's wrong, or they can only get the attorney's fees back. We oppose this because it's viewed as weakening the ADA. SB 855 by Charles Puchigian is another one of the ADA notification bills, which means that you have to wait a waiting period before you can take an action against an ADA violator. This one happens to be a 120-day a period of time. So I guess someone hasn't gotten the message from the last 3 years where these bills have died. Okay, I'm just going down here. That's really about it. That's it, really.
Thank you.
We'll take a couple questions.
Yeah, we're going to take at least two. Please raise your hand. We'll get the mic out there. Try and make sure they're short. They're at least questions, not a novelette.
It's Margie, and actually, I think this will fit in quite well here. It's just an announcement that pertains to anybody on SSI or SSDI. I was asked to make earlier and forgot to, so get ready to take notes. If you have ever received SSI or SSDI, and you have asked the Social Security Administration to communicate with you in accessible format, and they have never done so, or if you have gotten a notice that has interrupted your benefits because you could not read that notice, DREDF, Disability Rights Education Defense Fund, DREDF, is seeking individuals for a class action suit against SSA. So here's the person you contact. Larissa Cummings, 510-644-2555. And when you call, more than likely you're going to get a voicemail. Or if the receptionist is hesitant to put you through, tell her you're calling about the SSA class action. And if you're interested in being part of the class, you should probably call in the next couple of weeks. Thanks. 510-644-2555. You can also email Larissa at lcummings, C-U-M-M-I-N-G-S. I'll say that again. lcummings, C-U-M-M-I-N-G-S. At DREDF, D as in dog, R as in Randall, E as in elephant, D as in dog, F as in Francis. Can tell I don't have a ham license, right? At DREDF.org. That's lcummings at DREDF.org. Thank you.
Thank you. And do we have a question? Okay. With that, Dan, thanks again for a great report. Appreciate it. All right. You know, we've had some resolutions in the recent past. We've had resolutions in the recent past pertaining to pedestrian crossings, especially right turns on red lights and different things like that over the past year that I can recall. And probably to discuss and maybe answer a few questions on that issue, along with any other issue you might have in the same field. We have Captain Scott Holland with us, and he is a special representative to the legislature. He's the California Highway Patrol, California Law Legislative Pedestrians. Let's try Law Relative Pedestrians. And so with that, it gives me great pleasure to introduce Captain Holland. Captain.
Thank you very much. Is this fine? Is it okay? I have to start out by saying that it's interesting because I ended up meeting Dan and Gene over the phone a couple months ago. And matter of fact, they were looking into pedestrian law, and assembly member staff called me and said, hey, I got some questions about pedestrians. And we were going back and forth a couple times. And I dropped by to see her, and she said, hey, can we call Dan and Gene and get them on the phone and talk about pedestrians? And so we did, and we talked quite a bit about pedestrians, and it was actually a very good conversation. And from that, they said, hey, Scott, can you come talk to a group for us? And I said, I'd love to. And actually, the other interesting part is when I got home and mentioned to my wife that I'd been invited by the California Council of the Blind to speak to you, she was all excited, because she used to work in software, and she had nothing but good things to say about the council as she was working on accessibility issues. She just said, man, those are some great people. And so actually, if she wasn't working right now, she'd probably be here with me. But I want to talk today about pedestrians and cars, and I kind of said, what can I call this? And I said, well, how can we get along? I want to talk a little bit about a couple topics, and then hopefully we'll have a few minutes for any questions that you guys might have. But I want to talk about a little bit about pedestrian collisions, how those collisions occur, and what trends we see in California. I want to talk about basic rules for pedestrians and autos, but I want to approach it from the standpoint of what drivers view that as. And where do drivers get most of their information? From the DMV handbook. So I'm going to talk about a little bit about what's in the DMV handbook and how it's explained from that perspective. Then I'm going to approach it from the perspective of law enforcement and kind of give you a little insight on how we're trained to look at pedestrian violations. And then finally, they asked me to talk about some specific laws and fines and what the penalties are for a violation of those fines. But to put collisions in perspective, in California, every year we have over 300,000 people injured in traffic collisions. Of those 300,000 people, about 14,000 of them are pedestrians injured by automobiles. That accounts for about 5% of our injuries. In California, every year we lose about 4,000 people in collisions, in fatal collisions. And of those 4,000, about 675, or about 17%, are pedestrians. And so if you look at that, that's not good. That's about 1 in 6 fatalities as a pedestrian. And I can understand why, obviously, there's a lot of concern about that. But as you look at the pedestrian collisions, I found some interesting trends. Of pedestrians that were injured, 7.5% of them had been drinking. 7.5% of the pedestrians that have been injured in collisions were drinking. And that number actually jumps up quite a bit. Of those pedestrians killed, 28% of those were drinking. So as we always say, don't drink and drive, we might want to also say, don't drink and walk. But when it comes down to the cause of collisions involving pedestrians, these statistics will actually probably surprise you. 10% of pedestrians are killed by drivers who violate the pedestrians right away. And when I say that, 10% of those fatalities are the driver's fault. 30% of the injuries are caused by drivers who violate the pedestrians right away. But this next one will probably surprise you. 40% of the pedestrians killed are due to the pedestrians' violations. 40%. And so that's one of those things that just reminds us all to be careful. Matter of fact, I saw a bunch of them, but those of you who have the Support White Cane Safety, It's the Law t-shirts, I love those. And I love the back of those t-shirts because it says, close your eyes, now try and cross the street. Talk about giving someone a great perspective. I have a lot of respect for you guys, I'll tell you. It's scary crossing the street with your eyes open. But I want to talk about pedestrians a little bit. As I said, 1 in 6 traffic fatalities involves a pedestrian. And a pedestrian, when you go to the vehicle code, which is about the size of a phone book with all the laws talking about vehicles, a pedestrian is a person, and we all think of pedestrians as people, but there's a few other classifications that are defined as pedestrians. And so when we talk about pedestrians, we talk about these other forms of transportation also. So anybody who uses a conveyance such as roller skates, skateboards, a self-propelled wheelchair, tricycle, or quadricycle because of a disability, they're all considered pedestrians. Segway, yes. unfortunately, yes. But when we look at the DMV driver's handbook, it lays out a few things regarding pedestrians and those things. It pretty much says very basically, always stop for any pedestrian crossing at corners or other crosswalks. Do not pass a car from behind that is stopped at a crosswalk. A pedestrian you can't see may be crossing. Do not drive on a sidewalk except to cross it at a driveway or alley. And when crossing, yield to the pedestrian. Do not stop in a crosswalk. You will place pedestrians in danger. Remember, if a pedestrian makes eye contact with you, he or she is ready to cross the street. Yield to the pedestrian. Pedestrians have the right of way at corners with or without traffic lights, whether or not the crosswalks are painted or not. And it says, allow older pedestrians more time to cross. They are likely to die as a result of a crash, or more likely to die than younger pedestrians. And it kind of boils it all down to, in the DMV handbook, and it says, pedestrians have the right of way in crosswalks. And I don't think anybody here would argue with that. Now, I know a big issue with crosswalks and right-of-ways is always those folks who are making a right-hand turn on that traffic signal.
Mm-hmm.
Now, someone who's making a right-hand turn against the red, and I'm quoting right out of the DMV handbook, yield to pedestrians, bicyclists, or other vehicles moving on their green light. Yes, it does tell drivers, although quite a few drivers, unfortunately, don't follow those rules. Another thing I thought would be an interesting perspective, the driver's handbook actually has quite a bit of information on blind pedestrians. And it actually has a list of suggestions, and I want you guys to give me some feedback on how important these are. Here are some suggestions helping pedestrians who are blind, and this comes right from the DMV handbook. Don't stop your car more than 5 feet from the crosswalk. That good?
Yeah.
How about this one? Don't give the blind pedestrian verbal directions.
Especially if it's over there.
That's good, and they're wrong half the time. Don't wait too long for a blind pedestrian to cross the street.
And they're in the middle, speed up.
Well, maybe I better read the next sentence and it'll make more sense. If the person takes a step back and pulls in his or her cane, that's a definite sign that you should go. Is that true? Okay, good. I'm glad we clarified that one. Don't turn right on red without looking first.
Yes.
That's a basic one.
And maybe even without making a full stop first.
Stop at crosswalks where pedestrians are waiting.
Yeah.
Definitely good advice for the drivers.
Uh-huh.
Don't stop in the middle of a crosswalk.
Yeah.
Very good. Don't block a sidewalk.
You're right.
Yeah. And how about don't honk at a blind pedestrian to say hello? Boy, that was a favorite. Okay. Now let's talk a little bit about pedestrian responsibilities, because we all as pedestrians have a few responsibilities, and it's important we remember those. And I'm sure, I bet you guys are probably better than I am on these responsibilities. It says the pedestrian has to yield right of way to vehicles when you cross or walk where intersections or crosswalks are not marked. So if I decide to jet across the street in front of my house, I need to yield to all the cars that are coming. They don't have to yield to me. That's also considered. And then when you jaywalk across the street between intersections, does everybody know the definition of jaywalking?
Yes.
Jaywalking is when you cross between two controlled intersections that have a traffic signal at each end. That means if you got a traffic signal at each end, you're supposed to go to the corner and go to the crosswalk, unless there's a marked crosswalk. Some other advice for pedestrians: do not suddenly leave a curb or other safe place and walk or run into the path of a vehicle. Of course, I think we all learned that when we were young, didn't we? The law states that drivers must take care for the safety of any pedestrian, but if the driver can't stop in time to avoid hitting you, the law won't help you. And that's just the reminder that if we're going to go ahead and make sure that they yield right away to us, that we need to make sure that they can yield right away and not to step out in front of them. And then finally, at an intersection where traffic is not controlled by signals, drivers are required to yield right-of-way to you within a crosswalk, marked or unmarked. And when I say unmarked crosswalk, I mean if you're crossing at the corner. If you're crossing at the corner, there doesn't have to be painted white lines. If you're at the corner, that's considered an unmarked crosswalk, and vehicles have to yield right-of-way. But a major factor in pedestrian violations and auto pedestrian violations boils down to right of way. So I thought it'd be good to kind of define what in the world is right of way. Right of way is defined in the vehicle code, but I think the easy way to talk about it is it's basically defined as the privilege of the immediate use of the highway. One person has the privilege of occupying a given space on a highway. In other words, two competing individuals or cars can't be in the same place at the same time, because when they are, bang.
Something's got to give.
And so the concept with right-of-way is someone belongs there and someone needs to wait their turn. Now, the interesting thing is when you talk about a vehicle versus a vehicle right-of-way, so I'll give the stop sign example of I'm driving and I get to a stop sign. It says that I need to yield right-of-way to other vehicles until it's safe to go. So now let's set this up. So I'm sitting at an intersection, and there's a crosswalk next to me. We're both going to go straight across. Now, the law that applies to the car says that I have to yield right away to all the other vehicles. The law that applies to the pedestrian says that the other vehicles have to yield to the pedestrian. So if you think about this, the pedestrian actually gets expedited service across that street. Again, we got to get traffic to yield before that pedestrian goes. But the pedestrian's responsibility is to make sure they don't step out in front of a car that is unable to yield right of way. And that boils down to how fast they're going and how close they are. So if they're not able to stop, we can't expect them to yield right away. But if they're down the block or two or three, yes, we can expect them to stop. Right of way only comes into play if there's two folks that are going to try and occupy the same space at the same time. And again, autos must yield right away to a pedestrian within a marked or unmarked crosswalk. And I think it's interesting because when you talk about the law, every so often the Attorney General gets involved to try and make a determination of what was the legislative intent and how can that be enforced and how can that be applied. And in getting ready for today, I've pulled out an old Attorney General's opinion that talks about pedestrians and crosswalks because I figured you might be interested in what it says. And basically, the Attorney General, when it talks about yielding right away to a pedestrian, said this. The driver of a vehicle is required to yield the right-of-way to a pedestrian who has stepped into a crosswalk and halted if there is a danger of collision should the pedestrian resume his or her progress across the highway and the pedestrian has not conveyed to the driver or caused him to reasonably assume the pedestrian has waived his right-of-way. In other words, if there's going to be a collision, the auto has to yield right away if they can reasonably do so. And again, a couple factors I want to toss out about pedestrians. Who knows how fast pedestrians normally walk? 3 miles an hour. I hear a lot of the right number. Pedestrians typically walk 3 to 4.5 feet per second. Other interesting factors, and this is kind of the insight that when we're training our officers at our academy, we mention a few things about pedestrians. They walk at 3 to 4.5 feet per second. A lot of pedestrians resent being regulated by signals. Some are impatient, tending to disobey signals. And many lack knowledge of the vehicle code. But I think you would all agree that many of the drivers suffer from the same things. Now, let's talk about a vehicle stop for a pedestrian for a moment. The law requires that if a vehicle stops for a pedestrian at a crosswalk, no other vehicle shall overtake from the rear. Now, how many of you have had a close call where someone didn't exactly follow that rule? Or maybe I should ask the question, has anybody not had a close call? I think we all have. One of the things that when Dan and Gene asked me to talk is they said, can you go into some detail about what the law actually says and also about the fines? And so I wanted to spend a few minutes on that and make sure we leave a couple minutes for questions if you have some. But it's interesting as you look at the vehicle code that's, as I said earlier, about the size of a phone book. Most people have never read the vehicle code. Most people know the vehicle code based on the DMV driver's handbook or what our driver training instructor or someone else has trained us. But it's interesting when you get down to the nuts and bolts of what the law actually says. It's pretty specific. I want to talk about a couple things. Now, if a driver is facing a green signal and wants to make a turn, obviously there's usually a pedestrian in the crosswalk next to that green signal. And that's what we're worried about. And the law says any driver, including one turning, shall yield the right of way to other traffic and pedestrians lawfully within the intersection or adjacent crosswalk. So even if a driver's got a green light to go straight and is making a right-hand turn, they have to yield to the pedestrian in the crosswalk if that pedestrian has a green signal to go. Now, if you violate that, anybody know how much the driver's going to pay? Anybody want to guess?
$250.
I hear $50. Anything else?
$500.
Oh, I hear $500. Man, this is a tough crowd.
$175.
Well, actually, we're pretty close, but fines are very interesting because fines, when you look at fines and you look at what the base fine is, it's a little deceptive sometimes because the base fine for a driver who makes a right-hand turn and violates the right-of-way for a pedestrian, the base fine is
$35.
Oh. Now, don't get upset yet. That's just the base fine. Now, with all fines, there's something called penalty enhancements. and they add $10 for every $10 of fine here, and they add $5 for every $5 of fine there. They add a penalty enhancement. They add a 20% surcharge. They add a $20 flat fee. They add a $5 flat fee. They add a dollar for a night court. So basically, your $35 fine, as you say when you buy a car, what's with tax license and registration out the door? Your total price out the door is $134. Now, let's put that in perspective, though. Now, if a pedestrian violates the right-of-way of an auto, how much do you think that fine is? It's a $25 fine. Now, out the door, though, for a $25 fine, it comes in the neighborhood of about $99. So typically, when you look at violations, a good rule of thumb to talk about fines is, if it's a pedestrian violation or a bicycle violation, it's usually a $25 base fine for a total fine of about $99. Each county will go up or down a couple dollars. If it's a moving violation for an automobile, it's usually $35 for a total fine of $134. But there are exceptions, and let me get to one of those exceptions. Let's talk about, anybody have trouble with drivers making a right-hand turn on a red light?
Yeah.
Wow, this is a biggie. What, would it make you happy if I told you the base fine was a little higher than $35?
Uh-huh.
Would 50 sound good?
No.
Would 75 sound good?
No.
Would $100 sound good?
Yeah.
Well, it's $100, so that should make some of us happy. But remember, that $100 is only the base fine. Do you know what you pay out the door with a $100 base fine? It's a little bit higher. Do I hear more than 250? Not quite 500, it's $350.
Whoa.
So a base fine, and the reason that is red light violations are a big issue. And so what they wanted to do is they wanted to raise the price for red light violations, and they specifically raised that to $100. And a $100 fine equals a total fine of about $350. The drummers are back, unfortunately. And it's not the typical marching band, as I think they said earlier. It's a drum band, unfortunately. But the fine for a driver, and let me read the law for you. A driver facing a red circular red signal alone shall stop at the marked limit line, but if none, before entering the crosswalk on the near side of the intersection, or if none, then before entering the intersection, and shall remain stopped until the indication to proceed is shown, except as provided in subdivision B. That is what they get fined $100 for. That's the base fine. Total fine of $350. Now, unfortunately, and I implied this and I was incorrect, subsection B talks about when you're yielding right away when making a turn. And that says a driver making that turn, referring to a right turn on a red light, shall yield right away to pedestrians lawfully in the crosswalk. Unfortunately, that fine is $35. The other one is for running a red light. So if a driver runs a red light, it's a $100 fine. If they violate a pedestrian's right of way by making the right-hand turn, it's the $35 fine. Now let's talk about another law, because so far we've talked about just pedestrians crossing the street. But let's talk about blind pedestrians. And let's talk about blind pedestrians who are carrying a white cane or using a guide dog. There actually is a specific law addressing just that. And let me read it for you. 21963 of the California Vehicle Code says this. A totally or partially blind pedestrian who is carrying a predominantly white cane with or without a red tip or using a guide dog shall have the right of way. It's a little bit... It's quite a bit stronger than all the other right-of-way stuff because it says that pedestrian shall have the right-of-way. And the driver of any vehicle approaching this pedestrian who fails to yield the right-of-way or to take all reasonably necessary precautions to avoid injury to this blind pedestrian is guilty of a misdemeanor. Punishable by imprisonment in the county jail not exceeding 6 months, or a fine of, and this is the base fine, so remember it's going to be a little higher, a base fine of no less than $500. Now, a base fine of $500, Anybody guess what that is out the door? I heard 750. Do I hear a little bit higher?
900.
Do I hear 900? Do I hear a little bit higher? $1,000. Do I hear a little bit higher?
$1,450.
Do I hear a little bit higher? I feel like I'm auctioning it off.
$2,500.
You're a tough crowd. I think we just need to keep jacking it up. What do you think? You all agree? A $500 base fine equals $1,750 fine.
Yeah, and catch them.
So I gotta give you this. You definitely have the law on your side when it comes to fines for that, and there's good cause and good reason for that. And I'll tell you, I love those T-shirts. Those are awesome. Because I would say most drivers, if they close their eyes when trying to be a pedestrian crossing the street, I'm not sure they could get to the street, let alone get across. One other section I want to comment on before I probably close up and give a chance for a couple questions is sidewalks. And it was interesting when Dan mentioned the sidewalk bill, because Dan called me and said, hey, where's the highway patrol on the sidewalk bill? I said, well, we didn't have a position yet, but Dan, of course, brought it to my attention, and we were working hard on that. And Dan did such a good job, I didn't have to do anything. So, Dan, thank you. I appreciate that. And I got to say, I got to give a little plug for Dan, because I spend my entire, well, my whole job is to watch legislation and ensure that all the traffic safety stuff actually enhances traffic safety. And I got to say, I see Dan cruising through the halls of the Capitol. Of course, now that I see Dan, I can say hello, because I hadn't met him before. But I got to say, you got a good guy looking out for you and doing a good job, because I've seen him around, I've seen him in hearing, I've seen him testify, and he is watching out for you, so to speak. And when it comes to crosswalks, the law is very clear that you can't block a crosswalk. When it comes to sidewalks, the law is very clear you can't block the sidewalks, and that there are definite fines for those. The unfortunate part about that, Section 22500 that deals with that, is it's a parking violation that ends up dealing with each county is a little bit different, so I don't have a standard fine for those, but it is clearly against the law. But remember, if they're blocking the sidewalk because they didn't stop in the right place for stopping for a red light or a stop sign, the fine is the same as it would be if they ran that red light. So it's a pretty significant fine there. And so it's pretty funny as I look at different things. Do you mind if I give you guys a quick test here? I know I didn't tell you I was going to do this at the beginning, so we're going to find out who was paying attention and who wasn't. I pulled this out of the sample test from the DMV handbook. So it might stump you, so just hold on to your seats here. A pedestrian who's crossing your lane, now remember, this is for the driver's test. A pedestrian is crossing your lane, but there is no crosswalk. You should, A, make sure the pedestrian sees you and continue driving. B, carefully drive around the pedestrian. Or C, stop and let the pedestrian cross the street.
Yay.
Man, you guys are a good audience, I'll tell you that. But of course, being from the Highway Patrol, I got to close, I always got to end in this, is, and I'll modify it a little bit for this crowd. Don't drink and walk.
It's important.
Don't forget to buckle up and walk safely.
Okay, absolutely fabulous, fabulous. We have been looking for a presentation like this, I think, for years. And with that, we only have time really for one question, but I'm going to take prerogative, not on the question. I'll just say about 25, 30 years ago, there was a car blocking the crosswalk. And I was using a cane at the time, and I wouldn't do it today just because of the times, but I remember it was a four-door car, and I opened the back door and walked through on the other side and left both doors open on top of it. So, but I don't think I would try it in today's world.
Real quick question.
One question.
Okay, real quick. Okay. The sidewalk blocking, is that including residential areas, like when you're trying to walk down the sidewalk and cars are parked in the driveway and you have to go in the street to go get around them because they're bumper to bumper? Is there something we can do about that?
Yes, there is. The law definitely applies in that situation. And let me go ahead and read the law that applies to that, because it seems like there's an awful lot of interest in this. Section 22500 says no person shall stop, park, or leave standing any vehicle. That means they can't park and stop there for a little while. They can't leave it parked in their driveway. And it says on any portion of a sidewalk or with the body of the vehicle extending over any portion of the sidewalk, except electric carts when authorized by local ordinance specified in another section. So pretty much if I want to park my car in my driveway and wash my car and block the sidewalk, that's against the law. It's a violation. And if you do have an issue with that, you need to call whatever your local jurisdiction is that deals with the parking citations. And the way it pretty much works is if you live in an unincorporated area of the county, it's the highway patrol usually. And if it's within an incorporated city, it's the city police department, although some cities do have the parking attendants who many call the meter maids, who would be the folks that could come out and take care of that for you. And again, when it comes to private property, it gets a little sticky. I would. It sounds like you probably need to talk to your neighbor and remind him not to park the car in the sidewalk.
Okay, Ken.
Okay, that's. I'm sorry. That's really all we can do.
Not a question. I want it.
Okay, wait. If it's that, what is it?
I want to give this gentleman a T-shirt.
Oh well, we're not gonna. I didn't stop you from that.
Tell him about that.
That's the white cane safety shirt with the close your eyes on the back. Well, this is from the Redwood Empire chapter. If you get in touch with me, I'll let you know how to get them.
Man, I got to say a big thank you. These are awesome T-shirts, and I'm going to wear this proudly and make sure a lot of people see it, because it's very true. So thank you for the opportunity to come, and I hope that it was helpful.
Thank you again, Captain Holland. Just absolutely wonderful. One more round of applause. Let's hear it for him. This is when I wish we could put a stop on time sometimes just to keep going, I'll tell you. And who does? Silicon? Okay. With that, I'm going to bring about our last discussion for this session, for this afternoon. And listen up, ACB, out there on the web, because we're going to present and get some information out to you on California Department of Rehab. We're going to have an update on Blind Field Services with the Department of Rehabilitation. We have Gary Kuwabara, and Gary is the Chief Deputy Director, Department of Rehabilitation, and also we'll have Linda Bardis. Most of us know Linda, and she's Deputy Director, Specialized Services Division, Department of Rehabilitation. And Linda is, and it's not a surprise, and it's nothing I shouldn't say, because she has brought it up many times in the last day or two, at least, that she is going to be retiring, and we'll certainly miss her. We've had Linda around here for a long time in a couple other departments, and we really appreciate both of you being here this afternoon. I guess since Gary's name is first, are we going to start with Gary, Linda?
Mm-hmm.
Gary, would you like to take it, please?
Okay, well, I guess I'm first then. You know, I don't know about this following the highway patrol, and that's the first time I heard a lot of laughter when you talk to a highway patrolman. Usually it's the kind of the other way around, but I guess.
Where's your car park, Bill?
I won't laugh now. But I want to thank President Jeff Tom and the membership for inviting the Department of Rehabilitation to participate in your convention. Our director, Catherine Campisi, sends you her best regards, but she's unable to attend today because she's back on the East Coast. She's attending the Council of State Agency Vocational Rehab meeting back there on the national level to see what's going on. So I think I got an email from her, and I think what's happening back there is it's starting to rain just like here, so I don't know how pleasurable it is back on the East Coast. Rain on the East Coast is not like rain on the West Coast. We have a little bit of sun and still a little warm. Well, you know, I guess I'm the new kid on the block here with the Department of Rehabilitation. I've I've been appointed by the governor last July to serve as a chief deputy to the department, and it's been a wonderful pleasure. Now, I'm not the new kid. I mean, the new kid in terms of the Department of Rehabilitation, but I've been around for over 37 years. My biggest experience has been with the California Department of Aging, where I served as chief deputy and acting director a couple of times, serving our seniors of our state. So I had a great pleasure there. Actually, this is the first time I've attended one of your conventions, but actually I kind of halfway attended one. I think it was your fall convention. I happened to be in the Marriott Hotel, and I was walking through, and I saw a lot of people with canes and a lot of people with their dogs, and I called up Catherine Campisi, and I said, "You'll never guess what. There's a lot of people here with canes and dogs." And she said, "Well, that's because CCB's having their convention there, and Linda Bartis is there someplace." And so I walked through the lobby to go look for Linda, and I ran into a gentleman there, and I started talking to this gentleman and his wife, and we walked all over, and we're trying to find an escalator, I think, down to the, what was it, hospitality room, I think you have downstairs. And so they weren't giving this gentleman very good instructions in the hotel where things were. And so I took it upon myself, and I said, you know, this can't be this way. And then I started talking to him. It was Dan Kaiser. I said, I'm Gary Kulbar from the Department of Rehabilitation. He goes, oh, I'm Dan Kaiser with the CCB. I do their legislation. So we had a good discussion, and they headed off down the escalator, and that was the last I saw of them for a while. So that was kind of like halfway. I was halfway in one, and I'm at this one. I wanted to give you a few brief updates on some recent activities that might be of interest to you. One of the first ones, and that's why Catherine is back on the East Coast, is that they are currently reauthorizing the Rehabilitation Act. It's being heard back in Congress now. I don't know if you've had updates on that.
Yes.
Have you? Okay, so that they passed a House bill, H.R. 27, and what that really did, I'll just give you some brief points on it. It includes the director of the distinct state unit in the State Workforce Investment Board. That means we haven't been involved there now, but our director, like Catherine, would be on that work board representing the disabled community. They will no longer require workforce investment boards to include mandatory partners like the Department of Rehabilitation. But one thing they will still do is allow advisory boards, which the Department of Rehabilitation can be on to advise them, provide infrastructure costs to one-stop centers from our current VR direct service funds. You know what that means, right? That means that if they're gonna fund something else, they're gonna take it from where the funds are now, and that includes us. They also included what they quote as a transition services expansion year to improve and expand VR services for students with disabilities on a statewide basis when VR appropriation reaches $100 million above the 2004 appropriation. So with the consumer price index, that should reach that level at about 2006. And what they would do then is set aside a specific amount of funds from the state's allocation to fund that program. So you know where that money comes from, existing allocation. They're not putting any new money into that. They also would have the Rehabilitation Service Commissioner, currently appointed by the President, appointed as a director by the Secretary of Education. Many of the advocates are viewing that as a downgrade of the commissioner's office, and so they're having a lot of discussions around that. One of the pieces that wasn't passed in H.R. 27 but is looming and is a big point of discussion is the Workforce Investment Act Plus Block Grant. This would consolidate the Workforce Investment Act state grant from DOL, the adult training, dislocated worker training, youth training, and employment services grants as a consolidated grant as a requirement, and would give the state's governor's option for further consolidating veterans employment, trade adjustment, training, adult education, food stamps, employment training, and vocational rehabilitation. So that is another big issue that's back there. Right now, like I say, it wasn't included in H.R. 27. I think there was a lot of consternation from a lot of people that they were not really happy with that prospect that if they consolidated our funding with the other funding that we would come on top, because block grants are designed to reduce a certain level of funding, and that's why they call them cost efficient, to block grant them. The other thing that's happening right now is that Senate Bill 9 is currently in the process of markup. It means they're taking a bill that they've identified for their WEA reauthorization and are including things in there similar to what the House did to take a look at, discuss, and vote on. There's been some discussion that they want to include the WEA Plus amendments into that. There's also been discussions that they won't, but they might amend the bill when it gets to conference. And conference is just taking the House bill, the Senate bill, because they're different, and having a conference about them so they can decide which version they want to pass, or a compromise version. So there is that discussion that they might include the WEA Plus in either the Senate bill or in a conference. That is an administration-supported amendment. They're strongly supporting that now. I understand some representatives might even come to California to discuss that. I'm not quite sure when and how they're going to address it with California, but I'm told that they are going to come out here to push that. Let's see. The one big thing that's going on right now is that the administration has proposed reducing the regional offices of RSA, meaning we have a Region 9. It's currently in San Francisco, but we're under dual leadership from Region 10. We have a satellite office here now, and Noel Nightingale in Washington is kind of running both. Those positions, approximately 65 of those, are to be eliminated, and the regional offices eliminated by September of this year. There's a lot of discussion about that also, how we can get information into the administration, how the RSA regional offices have benefited the states by being available and close, how our cooperation and partnership has benefited us. So there's a lot of discussion about that now. At this point, the state has not taken any positions on those. They're still being discussed. And like I say, that's why a lot of it, Catherine went back to see what's really going on. And when we hear more, we can inform you. Let's see, what else do I? Okay. A few weeks ago, we had a visit from the government, U.S. Government Accountability Office, the GAO. They came to California, and April 6th and 7th, they had a review with the Department of Rehabilitation. We kind of asked them why they were reviewing at this point when, you know, reauthorization was coming up, and whether that was coincidental or was it something that they needed to do to get input in. They indicated to us that this was not anything to do with reauthorization, and that actually they had this review scheduled for a long time, and it had been about 10 or so years since the last review on any areas that dealt with disabilities, and that disabilities was considered a high-risk area because a large volume of dollars that goes into all programs that deal with disabilities. So they actually did come out and have a review with us, and it really went really well. They had about six or seven questions. There was one person from D.C. that came out, two people from their San Francisco office. The questions ranged from what organizational structure we were, and that's our designated state agency. We're the designated state department within the agency to administer the vocational rehabilitation program. Funding sources, and they were generally concerned with the match funding sources that we need to match the federal dollars with. The percentage is federal dollars is 78.3%, I think, and 21.7% for the state to match it. We have a lot of match with cooperative services programs that we have, which are kind of like a third-party match. You know, it's money that's there, but it's not really hard cash. They put in a lot of their time. That's like with the mental health and the education, the youth programs. They will put up some of their time they work and dedicate to our clients and their clients, our mutual clients, and we can use that time as match. So that's really kind of saved California a lot with the reductions that have gone over in the past few years. The operations, how services are delivered, they wanted to know how we deliver our services. And you know, basically, we have the activities we produce through the community resource programs and three forms of contracting with them. We explained, it's pretty detailed. I'm not going to take you through that. But so we explained to that. We explained also our order of selection that we're in California since 1995. That being, we can't serve everybody with the resources we have, so what we've selected to do is serve the most significantly disabled and the significantly disabled, and we've been able to do that, those two categories, without closing the doors since 1995. Well, I could hear their drumming for me out there. When I came in, there's a high, if you don't know, there's a high school marching band out there, and I don't know what they're celebrating here in our mall, but they're right outside doing their show, so that's what that drumming is. They also kind of question us on our program outcomes, our standards and indicators, the federal standards and indicators, and I'm sure a lot of you might be familiar with that. That's how we show that we're doing more employment outcomes and the that we're being successful in our economic outcomes and we're meeting the standards that they have. California has always met the standards. I think they've passed 5 out of the 6 last year. The one standard I think they were under is the number of outcomes. That number means that you do at least one more outcome than you had last year. With our economy and the employment that's going on in the state and the reductions, it was hard to meet the same level. Although we've had more consumers, we didn't have that one more outcome, so that kind of didn't pass us there. But overall, we did pass. And they ask us about our interactions with RSA, which we told them our partnerships with them have really helped us in California keep abreast of what's happening back in the federal government and also helped us advance our own causes here in California. They've been an instant reference for us, so that's been very helpful. That's kind of it for our GAO meeting. I met with Region 9 about a week ago, our own RSA Region 9, and there was one interesting – you probably would be interested in one thing there. The other stuff is probably dry. But they announced that Bill Palmer, the director of the Washington Department of Services for the Blind in Region 10, has been selected, and he's the new director of the Florida General VR Agency. So they've had him leave Washington, and now he's head of a general agency in Florida. The other issue is the Department of Rehabilitation budget stays pretty level. We've not taken any reductions in any positions or any funding. We're pretty level. The only thing we're asking for, and it's not for discussion, is we're asking for a couple new positions, and they're temporary. For a couple of years to deal with our Proposition 63. And I don't know if you know, Proposition 63 is the Mental Health Services Act where they passed a new law where anybody that has income over $1 million gets taxed 1%, and that 1% tax goes towards mental health. That's tentatively scheduled to generate maybe the first half a year up to $250 million and on through maybe year 6. To generate maybe up to $700 to $800 million a year for mental health innovation programs. We're asking for two positions to kind of help with us, our mental health co-ops. Mental health is about 1/3 of our population, so we're trying to deal with that to educate our own staff on the Mental Health Services Act and educate local mental health providers to upgrade their local mental health plans to include room for our clients in their program so that we can assist, like I say, through these cooperative agreements. We haven't got much time. We got to get going here, huh? So what I'm going to do at this point, I'll just knock off there. And I want to say that it's a pleasure to be up here with Linda Bardas. It's kind of ironic to say that I'm here at my first meeting, and she's probably here at her last with the department. I wouldn't say her last meeting she'll be at, but her last with the department. So I'll turn it over to Linda to kind of give you some specifics on the division that she runs.
Thank you.
Thank you, Gary.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Kathy.
Can you hear me? Can you repeat
this? I will repeat it.
I want to let...
You got a mic, I think.
I want to let Gary Kuwabara and Linda Bartis know that they will have tickets at our banquet. they had stopped me to tell me they couldn't get tickets because we were out, but you know what? They have to be there, and when we get there, you'll see why. I have to leave to go conduct my government affairs committee, but I want to say for Gary Kuwabara, when he came and he said, you know, he had come from the aged community, I thought, oh boy, here comes somebody else that doesn't know much about blind people. But I tell you what, from day one when we sat on a strategic plan in the Blind Advisory Committee, and from that time to this, he has showed a tremendous interest. He asked questions. He does care. He's doing a great, great job. And I think we're very lucky to have him. And, you know, I told him today when we stopped and had a brief conversation in the morning, and I said, well, I thought about it later, and I thought to myself, you came from the aged and you came to the blind. When you come to me, kid, you're in both corners.
Thank you, Kathy.
I thought that was a lie because she's got to be under 50, right?
Well, Kathy said what I was going to start out by saying, which is that since Gary's been with the department, he has shown a tremendous amount of interest in all of the programs, and he has been one of those managers, one of those upper-level managers that gets out and gets to know the people, and he was at OCB right away. He's been at some of the private blind agencies, and he was here Thursday afternoon and yesterday afternoon and today. So that just goes to show he is interested. However, he has talked through almost our whole time, so I'm going to have to...
You still have at least 5-10 minutes.
Well, 5 or 10 minutes is... Yeah, I was going to say, I would say, well, that's plenty to cover what we've done in blind services, but it's not. Okay, well, the last time I was here, last October, I was peddling strategic plans. We had just completed the strategic... I want to get it off of the stand because it's at the... Oh, thank you. Great. We had just completed the strategic planning process, and we were quite proud of all of the collaboration that the department had and all the great input from CCB and all the other advocates and the private agencies and the contractors and what the strategic planning gurus call stakeholders. And so let me just go really quickly through some of the main provisions of what we said we were going to do in 0405 and tell you where we are with those objectives, as they're called. First of all, as you know, the top priority for the department, having created the Division for the Specialized Services to Blind Persons and the SB 105 bill, the top priority was to increase the numbers of jobs. We like to call them in bureaucraties, employment outcomes, but they're jobs and careers. And so we are actually... in blind field services, we did dip the first year of the division in fiscal 03-04. We were down, and I think that the department as a whole was struggling to stay level and didn't quite stay level. The economy and all of those other issues were impacting us. But in addition to that, it was a tremendous transition, as you all know. But I am proud to report that at this point in this fiscal year, we have now turned the corner. As of March of 05, our outcomes are higher for 1 month than they've been for a very long time for 1 month. And if we keep that level of placement, we will end the year at a higher level from last year, and we are on our way up. Now, the first objective in the plan was to increase employment outcomes or jobs, but it wasn't that simple. It was to increase the overall numbers of people who get placed competitively, but within that number, it was to increase the ratio of people who are employed in integrated competitive employment as opposed to homemakers. And so we have instituted a lot of efforts to get that ratio into a more realistic number. And so I'm going to go over a couple of those measures that we've taken, because not only will they increase the number of competitive outcomes to homemaker closures, they will also increase, I think, the overall end result of jobs. For example, we must recognize that all counselors are vocational rehabilitation counselors. So we are asking all the counselor teachers to take vocational cases, and we are starting to provide training for all of them to be vocational counselors. We have instituted the concept of teams where the people doing pre-vocational and independent living are working together with the vocational people to come up with vocational goals for way more clients than they used to. In other words, it used to be that if a young person came in and they were quite a ways away from ultimate job, they would put them in a homemaker category. Or if a person, newly blind person, came in and said, I don't know what I want to do or if I can ever do anything again, what I need to do now is just adjust to blindness, they would put them in the homemaker category. And so what we've done is we've said, well, let's not do that anymore. Let's get a job outcome identified for just about everybody. And it may have to change over the few years of the case, particularly with an 18-year-old coming into the system, because we have very few blind 18-year-olds who know what they want to do downstream. And you're all supposed to say, well, that's true of all teenagers. And so anyway, yeah, right, and 30-year-olds. So,
60-year-olds.
Yeah. And career, and yes, career change types. Okay, and so just the sheer focus on identifying an eventual vocational goal is, I think that's going to make a big difference. And that's going to have the person thinking about what they want to do and the counselor thinking about what they want to do. And we're already starting to see those numbers rise. Another thing that we have done is we are trying to focus more on the kids, on the teenagers, on the high school kids, and get them more prepared before they come into our system. And I always put in a plug for this, for your advocacy organization, because you are so effective in advocacy, to not forget to beat on the door of the Department of Education to provide the kinds of services that our kids need in the schools, to learn Braille, to learn computers, to get technology into their lives before they get to us. So what we've done in that regard is we've identified a statewide youth coordinator, and so we picked out an extremely youthful person.
Never heard of him.
Richard Rueda has been named as our statewide youth coordinator, and I had told Richard I wanted him to come up and give you a rundown of what his activities have been and are going to continue to be to focus on youth and preparing young people for preparing for the world of work. But I really don't know if we're going to have time to do that, which is too bad because Richard is very enthusiastic and passionate about it. But I think this is going to be tremendous. He's working with the rehab counselors and throughout the state and making outreach to school districts, talking to parents, talking to kids, telling them about rehab, telling them about the importance of being prepared to think about work. And then, of course, we have the two summer programs for youth, one in the north, one in the south, one at the School for the Blind, one at the Foundation for the Junior Blind. We have a summer program at the Foundation for the Junior Blind. This is going to be our third summer. We do that by funding Foundation they're a contractor for that particular service. We also have an interagency agreement with the Department of Education to do that program in Berkeley. Boy, I tell you.
Well, that's going back.
That's like calling it the OCB in Oakland, right?
Right.
You can see why I have to retire. I can't even. Anyway, I want to remind you that we have these summer programs, and what they instituted in LA was the Saturday programs. After they go through the summer program, then once a month on Saturdays they're in an all-day class on technology and O&M and what's college like. And well, Ken's up here and very proud of that program, and it is a program to be proud of. And the same thing at CSB. So our counselors are well aware of those programs, and Richard is helping to get to outreach and get kids into those programs. But at the other real quickly, at the other end of the scale, we're trying to assist young people in being prepared for the world of college and the world of work. But we also have a whole lot of consumers that have entry-level skills or low-level skills and don't have aren't planning to go to college, university, and maybe the kinds of jobs that they need are fewer and fewer in our economy. This is true of all people with ill-defined skills, because all of those entry-level type jobs or task specific or assembly line or what, or even call center type jobs are moving abroad. And hopefully they'll be coming back. But what we're doing is we're instituting several projects to start placement / training programs for people with those kinds of skills. And we're not going to move back into the 19th century or even the first half of the 20th century into sheltered workshops. What we're going to build is an employment / training program where people can get work experience, can get evaluated, and then if they can move into competitive employment, they will, and if they cannot, they will have a job that will be prevailing wage with benefits. We met yesterday with a whole coalition of agencies, and we're building a kind of a statewide program to put these kinds of programs into place. But we began a value system where it would be prevailing wage according to the community. It would include health benefits, and it would be real work and not make work, and it would provide upward mobility and up and out kinds of opportunities if the people are interested and able to do that. So we have a lot of exciting stuff going on. I want to say that I really appreciate all of the input from the CCB and the Blind Advisory Committee and from all of you individuals over the last 2 years. The transition, it took a lot of work. It wasn't that it was difficult, but it always takes time, excuse me, to feel the impact, to feel the result of a major change. And the major change here, I mean, we already have the division. We had OCB and we had BEP in the division, but the really huge change was bringing all the vocational rehabilitation counselors into our division. And the whole point behind that was so that we could determine the people that went into blind services, that we could require education and experience and knowledge and understanding of blind issues, and so that we could have supervisors that specialized in blind services and knew really when the counselors were coming to them, knew the issues and understood the issues. We have put that system into place, but we haven't totally forged the complete result of having done that. Anytime you change an organization, especially a big organization, and I think probably particularly a governmental organization where you're facing a lot of bureaucracy, it takes a long time to feel the true impact. It could take up to 10 to 15 years in a lot of big, big organizations. I think we feel a lot of change already within the Department of Rehab because the other deputies in Employment Preparation Services have been extremely supportive of blind field services. The district administrators have been supportive. We are starting to attract some of their best counselors, which they're not, you know, I mean, they're, you know, they're not happy to see them go, but they're, you know, I mean, they're wanting to come over to, because they see that we're trying to be creative and proactive. So we're getting new counselors, and as we hire a new counselor, we're stressing the experience and the education and the competency as a rehab counselor. We're not hiring people because they're blind. We're hiring people because they're competent, motivated people, and we're fortunate that we have quite a few of those people who happen to also be blind. We also have three visually impaired supervisors. We have people that would not have taken the supervisor exam who recently took the supervisor exam because they know that they want to move up through the division and get into supervision. Our future is very, very bright in blind services. And I know that we have not accomplished everything that we would have liked to see happen overnight. But I feel that there are definite signs that we are moving in that direction. And I know that whenever I get together with y'all, it's a mixed bag. You tell me, yeah, this is great, but then we still have problems there. And I know Catherine and I and Jim Armstrong, too, we are always shocked when we hear stories. Well, my counselor told me we don't do that at rehab, or we're all out of money at rehab. We've been told, the counselors have told consumers, well, we can't buy you that because we're out of money. You know, we're like, oh, what? You know. So these isolated incidents will continue to happen for a while, but just keep working with us, and I think that you know, and you've met with Catherine and now with Gary, and you'll be seeing Gary again. I think you know that our intentions are strong, and we are committed to getting the job placements up, and it's just going to take us some time. Consistency was a big issue. We wanted consistency. We're still really working on that one. I know that's a big one that we still, but you have to understand that all of it, we've got 69 counselors and 9 supervisors and 7 central office staff in Blindfield Services. And almost all of those people came from different backgrounds and different parts of the department and different organizational cultures. So we're working on forging this team. It's going to take some time, but we're definitely aware that we still have consistency issues. And you also have to know that there's a responsibility on the part of the advocates and the consumers in the consistency issue, which is that the complaint is, well, Johnny got a Braille note and a laptop, and I didn't. The whole rehabilitation system is built on customized, individualized services according to the needs of each individual person. And the contract that is written between the counselor and the consumer, and it may very well be that the counselor made a bad decision, that Joey should have had the same exact stuff that the other consumer got. But it also may be that the skill levels were different and the needs were different. So we will never have everybody getting everything the same, no matter what part of the state they go into and no matter what counselor they talk to. What we need to be responsible for is that our counselors have a consistent approach, that blind people need all of the support, equipment, services, that they'll get all of those services that they need. I know, I'm being tapped on the shoulder. As long as they fulfill their end of the bargain, which is go to school, go to class, get the grades, go to training, get up in the morning, get to where they need to go. They fulfill their bargain. We're going to work on fulfilling our end of the bargain. And I just want to say to all of you, thank you so much for being CCB. My first experience was as a college student. It changed my life, and I just appreciate the whole experience of being with this organization for many, many decades. Like Kathy, I'm not going to give you any specific numbers, but it's been a long time. And so I'll see some of you tonight at the banquet. Thank you, and I'm sorry I went over.
Thank you. Thank you, Linda. Thank you, Gary. Richard, very quickly, Richard will be giving about a 10-minute presentation tomorrow morning about what his services are going to be in his new non-promotional upgrade to the same level. I tried to do that one. Again, thank you to both of you for just an excellent job. And, we're sorry we ran over a little bit, but again, these conventions and these programs are for the use of all of us here in CCB and to pass on to other blind, visually impaired folks. So, yeah, when we run over, there's always going to be a good reason. And because we ran over and a few of you stayed, we're going to do one door prize. Since there are a few of you here, we may have to call 400 names, but we're going to do it before we go to committee meetings. Another book from artists and $25 from Greater LA. And John Baradin, are you here? Try another one. Mike Cole, are you in here? Another one. Joe Smith, are you in here? All right. Hey, it only took 3 strikes. Thanks a lot for allowing me to run this session for today. And I certainly enjoyed it. And we also hope that all of our friends and affiliates out there in ACB Radio also enjoyed themselves listening to our program. We always put on some great programs. Go to your committee meetings. Get ready for a wonderful, wonderful banquet. And thanks to Jeff for allowing me to serve this afternoon.